So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review.
What's your time like, Damien?
Just... whatever.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
No.
The spirit of the Undertaker lives within the soul of all mankind. The eternal flame of life that cannot be extinguished. The origin of which cannot be explained. The answer lies in the everlasting spirit. Soon all mankind will witness the rebirth of the Undertaker. I will not rest in peace.
Last one, it was like length.
It was pretty, it was
fucking
great.
Long.
Yeah,
it was like 2 hours or something.
We're gonna hit like Joe Rogan territory soon. We're just gonna do 3 hour podcasts. Yeah,
were we recording that whole time?
Oh, this whole thing, it's we're at 8 minutes. Yeah.
This thing is constantly recording at all times.
Oh man, today. And then every time you guys go, well, don't worry, we'll edit it out or we'll edit that out. It's never edited out. Have there ever, is this like TNA here? Does anything ever get a second,
we don't do any retakes.
A second pass?
Yeah, we have bad editors.
Bad editors. Yeah. TNA editing.
They miss everything.
They miss everything. Yeah. Aren't you an editor here?
Yes.
Okay.
No, he only does video. He won't only video. Just audio.
Will not touch the audio. I will not sully my hands with that.
Oh, his dad didn't work in Vietnam, so his son can edit audio.
Didn't fend off Vietnamese pirates.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I don't know.
Completely
on. It's what we call a callback. Wait, ting.
It's called an inside joke.
An inside callback.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, Wei Ting, and the returning Damien Abraham.
I'd
from
like
fucked
to,
up.
Like to talk. Thank you for having me back. Thank you guys. Thank you. I'm honored to be back. I feel even more of a fan. I feel like I'm even more of a fan this time because I've now listened to 70 hours of you two reviewing wrestling.
Well, do you know what the comparison is? You listening to 70 hours is the same as me and Wei opening a magazine and seeing your mangina, because we feel we know you now even more than last time.
I want to explain the mangina and spin.
First of all, how was that like a huge deal when they asked you to like be on the cover here?
Actually, it was
pretty
funny.
Cool.
I was listening to a Review Away podcast, and I'm not going to pretend. I think it was something to do with the invasion angle in a hotel room in Trondheim, Norway. And then, like, you know, those emails kind of keep coming in. There's nothing to do when you're sitting in a freezing cold country, but check your emails at night. So I'm checking my email, and this email comes in, like, we want you to be on the cover of Spin. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is just the craziest thing ever. And then they're like, it's just you. can you tell the rest of the band? I'm like, and then I had all these visions of Don't Speak by No
Doubt.
Yeah,
exactly.
Kind of playing out in my head, you know, like, just you, come a little forward. But yeah, no, Spin was a magazine that I was a huge fan of, and still am a huge fan of. And I'm not just saying that because they put me on the cover. I legit had a subscription and still have a subscription. Maybe why they put me on the cover. But so to be on there is really weird.
I saw a tweet from you that you went to buy a copy.
Yeah, I bought it.
The guy at like the 7-Eleven didn't compute the two.
Not at all.
He's on the cover buying his own magazine.
I was like, and I put it looking at him, put on my best. Like I didn't strike the exact same pose.
I should have gone in the outfit,
but then it's like, but then you know, it's more the most embarrassing thing about buying a magazine with yourself on the cover is having to carry it around because you didn't want to pay 5 cents for the bag, and then you're holding this magazine with your face on, and there's no way to hold it without making it look like you're either holding pornography or. Or a magazine with your face on it.
I don't think me and Way will ever be on a magazine cover. Well, maybe Way will.
I think you guys will.
Way is like morphed into this like subculture. You're a genre all by yourself. Me, I'm...
Okay. Are there pro wrestling podcast magazines out there?
Not yet.
Not yet. But you know what? Print, especially magazines, is such a growing industry that I'm sure it's only a matter of time.
Oh, yeah.
Matter of time for some brave entrepreneur.
Oh, yes.
Maybe that'll be a WWE venture, because they seem to be so good at kind of jumping on things just at the dying days of.
Well, they had, at a time, they had like three magazines, didn't they? They had kids, they had...
They had all those magazines.
And Raw, yeah.
And the Divas specials, so they're all over that.
They were also on the covers of Playboy, too, so they were kind of dominating newsstands for a while, probably on sports and fitness or magazines and
based on the stuff. WWE curve of technology, about 5 years from now, they'll probably launch a podcast on WWE.com.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. Could you imagine a podcast that would be like Michael Cole, but just stripping away the visuals? So there's just like, it's just the commentary.
Yeah. WWE produced podcast just, where everyone's in character and it's scripted.
For a time, when Howard 101 launched on Sirius, Cole and Taz hosted
They
show.
Did.
Out of character.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Out of character.
You had like Michael Cole like just telling fans to fuck off when they'd call in and say sucks. Yeah.
Well, they're encouraged to swear too, right, on Sirius. So
Taz, I think, is the most... like his on-screen character is just like I personally just think he's mentally checked out of TNA.
Yeah,
It's like when you talk to this guy, like he follows MMA and stuff, and it's like I think he could be a very valuable asset if he was just allowed to just be himself. You know what I mean? But I think you get such a view of him on TNA where it's just the complete opposite.
Then again, with a guy like Taz, I don't know how comfortable he is playing himself, because I don't know if he's ever played himself on his commentary.
I'm basing this all off this interview I did with him last year, and it was like, we talked for like 40 minutes, and it was just awesome. Like, I would love to hear this Taz, and not the Taz I get just...
It's just Taz at this point, like, how would you get fans to think of him as the Taz Mission? You know, kind of like the suplex machine. Like, there's no way you could do that. I think he'd be better behind the scenes. You know, because he's a terrible announcer at this point. And, like, it's almost perfect for the WWE product when they were, like, kind of going for that super PG thing, because he's like that, whoa, this is unbelievable, like, children's narrator type thing. Let the pigeons loose, you know. But, yeah, seeing him say stuff like that now is just creepy. And him and Tanae together, someone's got to break that boys club up.
I think Tanae is great, but like the thing with the TNA commentary team is just they sound so hokey, you know. Like,
sounds so hokey.
I don't think anything coming out of them sounds sincere ever. It just seems like they're shooting out a sequence. They're told to be enthusiastic, and that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah, and you can't. Yeah, like I guess as a. You know, if TNA now that I'm like, you know, week in and week out, it just reminds me of watching American Gladiators as a kid. Like, you're in the same set, you got the same people that don't really care, and like watching, and it's just like,
Laser and Nitro stuff.
Yeah, like Laser and Nitro, and like you've got that ridiculous set that now looks really dated.
It's probably from the same studio.
No, American Gladiators was way bigger draw. That was drawing legit crowds. Like,
Rollerball was from that studio.
Rollerball. Yeah, exactly.
You've been to the Impact.
I have, yeah.
And it's like extremely tiny.
They also filmed Guts. I don't know if you guys ever.
Oh, really?
Guts, where they ooze people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they filmed it from that set.
Wow.
Do you guys remember that the Canadian? You can't say that on television.
Can't do that on television.
Yeah. Mm.
Oh, absolutely.
I was like a little kid. I caught like the tail end of it, but fuck, I love that show.
That was like a Lance Morissette and Matthew Perry both were on that show.
Matthew Perry was on.
Yeah,
that show.
That really? Is like that is a Canadian a Mickey Canadian Mouse show. Club. Wow. Yeah, that's the Canadian Mickey Mouse Club. That's where we have our stars.
When I was 14 years old, I was almost an extra in a movie with Matthew Perry and Neve Campbell that was shot in Hamilton.
Really?
I responded to this ad to be an extra, and I got accepted to it, but I had to get to Hamilton, and I was 14, and I couldn't...
What movie was that?
Oh, Christ. It came
like
out in 98.
TV movie?
It's one of those...
I don't know if it was made for TV. I don't even know what the name of
one of those wildly successful Friends film ventures that, you know, like
could have it.
Did any one of those people make
a Three to Tango?
Three to Tango was it. That was it. It would have been four with me.
My friend Graham, who actually works downstairs as a closed captioner, he married Neve Campbell when he was five.
Balls. What?
When he was 5 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Like when they were little kids, they grew up as like family friends, and they got married when they were five.
You're serious.
You're not joking. He's downstairs. We could bring him up if we wanted to. That would be like, if you were a listener at this point, I would tune off if we did bring up Graham for this.
That's the great part about Canada. You can walk down the streets of Toronto and do 6 degrees of separation.
Oh, absolutely.
Like Neve Campbell, Keanu Reeves, and like a hockey player.
Oh, everyone knows everyone through somebody in Toronto, I find.
So what else? Last time we had you on, we were chatting about, what was it, No Mercy 99?
Yeah.
Featuring Midian having sex with goats.
What a difference 5 years earlier makes.
Yes, it really does.
You know, what a shocking transition that product made.
So how quick after you said, oh, I can come in this Monday, and me replying with, cool, we're doing the Rumble in 94, did you think, you know, these guys will probably have me in whenever I'm around?
No.
I want to do the 94 Rumble.
I'm excited to do the 94 Rumble because this is like, you know, this is, I find, a really interesting period for WWF, I guess, at this point, as they censored on the version we watched. At first I had to rewind. I'm like, did Vince stammer with his name of his own company? Like, I cannot believe this. And then I rewound. I'm like, no, they just edited out the F. But like, this was a really weird time because you didn't really have, you know, this is the post Hulk Hogan, pre-Attitude Era time where there's not really a main babyface star. And like, I think the obvious main babyface star, you know, the one who seemed to be, to me, the main obvious babyface star, Randy Savage, was kind of relegated to a mid-card level on this show, I thought.
Yeah, there was at this point where Vince kind of had it in his head that Randy Savage was kind of past his prime.
But then you see when he comes out in that Rumble and the crowd erupts. Yeah. Like, that is definitely one of the bigger kind of explosives.
Was Savage not injured at this time as well? Didn't he have injuries to deal with? Wasn't that like...
He was doing pretty...
It was pretty much like Vince just wanted him to be done in announcing at this point. Like, he just thought there was no value left in Randy Savage. And this was in 1994.
And he was still... Because he was going off the top ropes a lot, and he was still doing... Well, I guess you could still be protected in that, but looked like high spots.
He was only like... 54 when he died. So at this point, I mean, like late 30s.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So not in wrestler years. I mean, not too bad.
Yeah.
His knees weren't shot at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But Wei, you, by the way, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you.
You just came back from the Bahamas.
Oh, yeah.
As I guess we discussed on Monday night.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Great episode of Raw.
Yes.
How did you watch this show? Because you were without internet for a week.
I downloaded it, but I
found it.
Went to a bar that happened to be showing it on C.
I downloaded a backup copy because I already own the original.
Exactly. Of course.
I'm legally allowed to own a backup. So I did that beforehand, and I watched it on the bus. I took a Greyhound from Toronto to New York. I boarded a cruise, by the way. Why don't I just talk about it? I boarded a cruise to the Bahamas from New York. And so I took a Greyhound with me and my parents to New York. And on the way back is when I sat down and watched it on Megabus. Megabus. Not the Greyhound. I don't know if you've ever taken it.
I hear they have internet. They have internet for free on it.
It's shitty. It's really shitty. It's so slow. But anyway, I just watched it on a laptop. Man, I still feel, as I'm talking right now, like, I don't know if either of you have ever been on a cruise. You're about to. I know, Damien.
The only time I've been on a boat for an extended period of time is we snuck into China from Japan to do a tour.
Yeah.
and we took a boat from Osaka to Shanghai for 48 hours, and everyone on the boat except for the crew and our drummer was vomiting. Luckily, we paid for first class, which I assure you was not first class by anyone else's definition, because the main sleeping area was just mats on the floor. And the sea was so rough, people were just rolling in and out of each other's vomit all night.
Hold on, they have first class on an illegal boat?
Well, it's not even, when I say we snuck in, I don't want people to think that I'm like that hardcore. We snuck in as tourists and pretended not to be a band.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a legal boat, but it was, you know, should be illegal.
And how long were you on the boat?
48 hours.
48 hours, wow. Well, yeah, it seems like you probably felt it, because like I'm still feeling it right now.
Yeah.
Just that wavy feel while I'm in here.
I don't think I could do it. I've never been on a cruise, and I could never imagine being on a boat for a week.
It was nuts. But the boat was great, though. Norwegian cruise lines.
Don't promote anyone that doesn't pay us.
And they had, you know, constantly had entertainment. This boat was like huge. It fit like 2,400 people, 1,000 staff. So like you had like almost half of what the crew consisted of, basically, you know, one crew member for every person on board. And it's basically like a giant city block that's like moving on the sea at all times.
There's like a movie theater, right?
There's a theater. They always had, you know, shows. They had
24-hour restaurants.
Yeah. They had bands playing all the time. So, like, it was a lot of fun and a great time.
See, this sounds perfect to me. Like, I just wish someone would build it on land.
But then there's no
go to a secluded part of a city.
I would like to stay in a mall for a week. You know, stay in a mall. You know, someone's like, hey, there's a mall with a nice bed up there, and you can just stay here and then walk around the mall and go to movies.
There's not as much of a point, though, if you're just trapped in a place.
That's true. I guess Great Wolf Lodge is kind of like a mall that you'd like
to stay in. Great Wolf Lodge, what is that?
You know, doesn't know that?
It's no. Like,
you pass it when you drive to St. Catharines, Niagara Falls, and it's like this huge, it looks amazing, but it's like this giant water park thing that like families go. It's like a resort, but in Canada. Well, and an indoor resort.
The only thing me and Wade leave the city for is cover fights.
to cover
that's our
fights.
Traveling.
Are they having
Wade will go on a vacation
yeah,
every now
exactly.
and then.
Yeah. Well, so why don't you book an indie show there? That's Great Wolf Lodge. That would be a fun place to see a show.
I'd be there in a second.
Someone anyway. Suggested, Way, that or, you and I should promote an indie show. It's like, not on your life. If I have a propensity to lose money, I'll go into
You guys should bring the TNA cruise to Toronto do it around Toronto Harbor.
Hold on. Is that called the Bruise Cruise?
Oh, that's what ours is called.
That's what the TNA cruise is called.
We're doing a cruise. We're playing a cruise coming up in February called the Bruise Cruise as well.
Are you sure it's not TNA sponsored? How awesome would that be?
It would be unbelievable. Actually, you know what? Would it be that awesome at this point? Like, would I really want to, like, look up from, like, breakfast and see Scott Steiner, like, you know, hitting on my wife or, you know, like that? It's not like...
Devon and his kids
fighting at the buffet.
Oh, you've clearly not seen Genesis yet.
No, I know. I heard that. I haven't.
Reconciliation.
But I was listening to the podcast on my walk over, and I hear they reconciled last night.
Yeah, 3 weeks after being laid out by chairs.
That happens.
You know, fathers and sons have disagreements.
Being a wrestling fan is living for like 2 week periods where things get amazing, and then it's like the rest of the time it's like watching tapes.
It's an exercise in forgiveness
because you are constantly being bummed out by things. You know, like it's just like we get that CM Punk thing or the Nexus thing or like there's always something, the Matt Hardy thing a couple years ago where there's like you're like, oh my god, it's gonna get so good.
Yeah.
And then it just lets you down.
They're like relationships.
It is like a relationship.
Nothing summed it up better than when we had Brian Mann on, and he was like, yeah, we were all so excited, the writing team, we were all so excited after the Punk thing, but then one of the guys was just like, man, how are we going to fuck this up? I'm like, these are the people writing and saying this. What the fuck?
It must be something when you get there. It must be like, you know, when you watch some TV show, like game show at home, you're like, I can do that. That looks so easy. And then you get there and there's something about being there that changes you. That must be what it's like for WWE creative.
Well, to me, like it seems like it's epidemic of the system involved and not necessarily the people, because I mean I feel like anybody who's on that team is probably quite talented.
Oh, absolutely. Probably, yeah.
You know, if they were to sit down by themselves and write something by themselves, like maybe a movie director would or a comic book writer, they'd probably come up with something quite concise.
Like
and
imagine you being in a band with 20 people, mm-hmm. all who have a different idea.
And who have enough power.
And you got to get all your shit approved by X amount of levels above you.
You're like being in Broken Social Scene.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, like 27 levels of management. No, I absolutely agree. It must be something with the system. It must be like, because, you know, it must be like a police officer, I think, is a good analogy. Like,
yeah.
You know, like so many people probably go, like, I want to be a cop so I can be a good, nice person. Then, you know, 6 weeks later, you're busting a kid for smoking a joint, and you're like, this is not what I signed up for. But it must be the same thing with WWE. You're like, I'm going to go and I'm going to save wrestling. I'm going to make the best wrestling product I can. And then you get there, and it just breaks you.
Killing young men one person at a time.
Yeah.
Well, let's chat about the Rumble 94,
boy.
Now that we've painted this beautiful picture of pro wrestling at its finest in 2012.
At least there are these windows now of greatness. In this period, I don't know how many. There are some amazing matches and amazing people, but it's you know, I think he was even then more under the thumb of Vince McMahon, even if imaginable.
Maybe. Well, for me, this was perhaps, I know, Damon, you came to wrestling at a later time than I guess most fans would. Mm-hmm. But for me, this was when I came into wrestling for me. And the reason I chose this was because I still have very fond memories of this show. This was around the time.
This one or 95?
It's this one. And I'm pretty sure. And
Damien's the greatest guest because he gets every reference.
I did get the like, I remember when you're like, oh, I thought it was this one, but I picked this one.
We forgot to edit that out, too, I guess. But no, like, I mean, this was when I started watching. I guess I started watching around, like, late 92, but, like, this was when I was really, really into it. I was a huge, huge, huge Bret Hart fan, and this was really, you know, in the thick of his rise to the top in the company.
Mm-hmm. And did you realize this pay-per-view was on a Saturday, not a Sunday?
Did not realize
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, look this up. Had to look this one up, actually.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You guys were talking about that. Like, imagine if WWE ran this on this day instead of that day when you were talking about the UFC thing a couple
uh-huh.
weeks ago.
Right, uh-huh. Yeah. I don't know. I can't imagine WWE doing very well on Saturdays. It seems Sunday is so...
Well, I think Saturday at that point, because you would have Saturday Night Main Event, you know, like it wasn't... Yeah. I don't think Saturday what it is...
I don't even know what the reasoning was behind this. Maybe there was a big NFL playoff game on the Sunday. Yeah. I have no idea why they ran the Saturday.
Was this January 1st?
This was January 22nd. 22nd.
Okay, sorry. Because they had January. They had a stinger for January 21st, but I guess it was just a promo.
Maybe
January
it was 1st. Super Bowl or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could have
been.
I
don't know.
No clue. I was 10.
I was 14, just getting into girls. Didn't care about wrestling then. I'm like, man.
Priorities.
We hit 14 and it didn't change for us.
Pick up a girl and say, hey, Saturday night, we're watching the Rumble at my place. I don't know.
Let me tell you, at 14, I was making the transition from a kid who was playing Dungeons & Dragons, and I assure you, inviting a girl over to watch the Royal Rumble, it will probably be more successful than inviting a girl over to come play Dungeons & Dragons with you Maybe. And your friends.
Oh, you for know, wrestling.
In the pecking order of nerds. A wrestling nerd is higher than a Dungeons & Dragons nerd. And trust me, I've been both.
Yeah, Magic Cards below that.
Magic Cards is, yeah, it's a sub below. But unless you're really good like yourself, John.
Oh, dude, when I was like 13, man, it was wrestling and Magic Cards.
I know, you won tournaments. Like, you were a legit player.
I went to the local Slammers on Young Street. And yeah, man, I was okay at it.
Here's my most embarrassing story is my mom comes into my room one time. And she's like, what's this I found in your pocket? And it's like the paper that the sort of the plastic that used to come around magic paper. She's like, I found this. This is the packing for cigarettes. And I'm like, no, it's for my magic cards, Mom. She's
oh,
like,
man.
Oh, really?
And oh, I'm, sure it is.
Yeah. And she's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, here they are. They fit right in there.
There was as much as people joke about magic cards and shit, there was a big controversy about them when they were out that it was like teaching kids like fucking demonology
about Satan
and
stuff.
Satanic rituals and shit.
I bought one pack and then my mom busted me for smoking cigarettes when it was actually magic cards. And I was so embarrassed I never played it again. that was my transition. This is 94 for me.
I took up smoking.
I took him smoking. I'm like, this is way better for me. This is way cooler. I guarantee you, though, let's be honest, smoking will attract more members of the opposite sex than playing magic will. Yeah, and that's smoking being the most repulsive thing on earth, too.
I don't know about that, man. Geek chic is in.
That's
geek
true. But in. There's like, geek chic is in, like, hey, I'm geeky, I like pavement. And then there's, hey, I'm geeky, I play magic cards.
I don't know, man. I think certain girls would be down with that. I think it all depends on passion, if you can be a passionate guy about anything.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you. And I'm not dissing magic players at all. Like, I'm a record nerd. I am contemplating right now dropping $1,500 on a record, one piece of vinyl.
Wow.
I'm thinking of, I'm going to have to, like,
what record?
Negative Approach, Test Press, the alternate version of their 7-inch.
$1,500?
Yeah, $1,500. There's only 5 copies in the world.
There's enough demand for this particular record that warrants that price.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I'm
going to have to sell a bunch of records to get it. But
sure, you could get a deal, Damien.
Like, no, this is actually a deal.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
This is $1,500. It went for $3,000 last time it sold on eBay. That's one amazing. Of them sold on eBay.
Wow. So, I'd be so scared to make that big a purchase on eBay and rely.
No, this is in person. I'm going to be making this
in person.
But sometimes you got to do that, though. No, you got to make a purchase.
That's
like
what I was thinking. I'm like, you know what? This is one of those things where this is like an artifact for me. Mm-hmm. And this is like, it's a Negative Approach 7-inch. And John Brandon from Negative Approach, holy shit, are people going to be bored by this. But John Brandon from Negative Approach is like my Frank Sinatra. Like, that is like, to me, the greatest vocalist of all time, like, wow, for doing a harsh vocal. And like, this 7-inch is such a magical piece of vinyl for me that I have to... Maybe
you got
to
do it, man.
You're the first person that I've told this to that has been like, "No, I say do it, man."
I say that coming from the perspective of somebody who you know, who has those cravings sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, you got to take advantage of those, because you're not always going to have those urges. Like, maybe, you know, a year from now you're not going to care. And
please don't say that, because then I'll have a $1,500 piece of plastic.
Well, the thing is, like, you might not, care about it later on, but the moment that you get the joy is so great.
Well, and also, it's like, it is one of those things where, you know, money doesn't go to print, but records do. So I could always sell a kidney,
sure,
sell blood. People buy plasma in America.
No, they do it in Canada, too.
I don't think you can sell blood in Canada.
Oh, it's only donation.
There's only donation in Canada.
I just
America so much better.
I just how come, like, I rarely hear about people vying for wrestling memorabilia? That's
people do.
Much.
Do you ever hear that interview with Zack Ryder on Colt Cabana's podcast?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, dude, he was crazy. Like, here they are. They're all in Florida and developmental, like, starving. And Zach's, like, fucking buying every wrestling figure that comes out. He collects every figure.
Mm-hmm.
And Cabana's just like, him and Kurt Hawkins.
Yeah, like, went and hid a package of toys or something.
Hawkins, like, called him and was like, hey, the whatever, the Toys R Us has the brand new Benoit Eddie 2-pack or something.
Yeah, so Ryder hangs up and calls his dad, and he's like, "Dad, you got to get over this Toys R Us. Kurt,
scoop it up.
You got to scoop this thing out that's stashed hidden here.
Hawkins is going to grab it."
And so he went down and got it. But he's also like, he was buying all this stuff on eBay. Like, packages would be showing up every day of stuff.
Toys, huh?
Yeah. And when he got to WWE, he was just like grilling the merchandise department about, like, obscure t-shirts that they had made at different times.
Wow.
I went on eBay one day because I was like, I want to get some ECW figures. And, there's a lot of that stuff on eBay. Like, I think it's, you know, once again, it's within small markets, you know. How much did that ring go for when the Hall of Fame ring was sold on eBay?
Oh, Superstar Billy Graham.
Superstar Billy Graham sold it,
right? I don't
know,
man. I don't know how much that
I bet it went for a few thousand dollars, at least.
I went through the eBay craziness. I got an account when I was, like, 16, 17. And for me, it's, like, I think similar to your record thing was, it was the idea of getting it.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Like, and I had it in my mind where I'm going to get every pay-per-view ever. Stupid.
Wow.
Just stupid, because I got the same week I signed up for an eBay account, I got my first credit card. Just retarded.
Uh-oh.
And it was just like, I'm never going to watch all these. I just want to have them.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And I just went for 3 months, and then I was like, I had to have an intervention with myself. I was like, listen, I've spent like $500 here, and like, in when I'm 17 years old, $500 might as well have been a million.
You're talking VHSs?
Yeah.
So you had, like,
order. That's why I have all these old fucking tapes, man.
You got them through eBay.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I got them for, like, you know, just find little. One guy was like, every pay-per-view from 1989. Fuck, buy it, man. And I didn't have the patience for the bidding shit. I just hit the buy now.
Buy now.
Probably cost myself lots of money in the interim. And one fucker, man, screwed me. I was like, I paid $75 for like a bunch of shit, and he never sent it to me. And all I could give him was a bad report, and I fucking like lost my money.
Yeah, I got ripped off for like $200 on eBay one time.
Oh, I was just so mad. I private messaged him. I was like, asshole, what the fuck? You've got $75 of my money.
I
no
still
response,
this,
nothing.
I still have the dude who ripped me off's address. I'm going to go to his house one day and be like, yo, you owe me the Eat Communist Radio 7-inch, which is worth way more than $200. So, but anyway, no, I got ripped off too. It's one of those things that like, but when you first get on that eBay and everything you
it's
want
fucking
there.
It's addictive, man.
Oh, it is addictive.
I just got my first eBay account.
Oh.
Now?
Like, this month, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and I haven't bought anything yet, although I've tried.
Sign up for MySpace?
No.
Jesus, you're
you should
be working for WWE. They're fucking IT department.
Exactly.
This eBay.
But no, but like I'm still trying to figure eBay out because like I was trying to bid on like this
keep going.
Talking magic cards and everything. I'm trying to bid on the Uncanny X-Men Omnibus.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, I
dude,
know
these
them.
Are like
yeah.
fucking
I
thick
know.
Books. These are, and like. Like, they're, like, $200 books that are just basically, like, huge collections of, like...
Yeah,
of
classic
all
issues.
The stories,
yeah.
You know, bound together. And, like, I'm trying to master the art of sniping, of
well, you know what? People are using programs, right? E-Sniper.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah,
I didn't know about that until I had to do my research. Because, like, I tried to do it, and, like, the first time I did it, my time ran out. And by the time I even hit the bid... It logged me out automatically, so I had to log back in, and like it was just a big mess.
Oh yeah,
I'm still trying to figure eBay out.
No, I'm like a couple years eBay free because I eventually just made my wife take my password and was like, I can't have this.
Oh, it's so thrilling, man! Like as that clock counts down,
it is. I like how they call it winning because really you didn't win anything.
You have the right to buy.
You won the right to buy it. Yeah, but you didn't win. It's like congratulations, you won.
Welcome to the first world, everybody.
Yeah,
this is what we.
Yeah, this
for.
Is it. This
the
is
opportunity to buy more.
Exactly. At least we're buying other people's old junk on eBay. You know, it could be worse. We could be buying new stuff.
Yeah.
Right, that we're recycling. We're environmentalists.
Mm. Before we actually get to the Rumble, you've yeah, been you've
we're
been
not going to actually. Dude, this is the whole show.
I don't care. This is awesome.
Yeah.
You've been out of touch with everything, but Zack Ryder's latest video features Art O'Cal.
No way!
Whoa!
Art got into it.
What is he doing?
He was outside some nightclub in Toronto, and Situation was there, and Arda interviewed him, and he asked him, are you familiar with the hashtag, are you serious, bro? And Situation just, like, kind of big-timed him and was like, nah, I got my own shit. And Zack Ryder put it into his video this week. So.
Well, that's
wow.
Awesome.
So,
that's
Arda,
huge.
Mr. Big Time now.
Yeah.
Jeez. Zack, you know, do you think they're going to give Zack Ryder that match against the Situation at WrestleMania?
Oh, no. Was that even part of the rumor?
Well, that's one of the rumors I've been hearing.
I don't see it happening.
I don't know how popular the Jersey Shore would still be. Although, have you guys...
I just feel wrestling has milked the shit out of that show. I just don't care at all about Jersey Shore, actually, I watched before it got into wrestling. And now, after it all, I just can't watch that show
But if
anymore.
You have, like, him come in and you have him team up with a heel and you have the Situation be the bad guy, be the heel, and then so it all builds up... to Zack Ryder, this babyface, finally just beating the shit out of the situation. I think people still would get a good reaction from seeing that. Like, I think people
him
love
getting beaten up.
Yeah,
because they never do that with celebrities.
No, like him, like pulling him in, like you protect him the whole time. Like he's not actually wrestling Ryder. It's Ryder wrestling, like not Swagger maybe, but someone else. And then, you know, and you have the Situation in his corner, because the Situation would be a great mic talker. You know, he'd be.
Oh,
a great,
yeah, I'm sure he'd be fine in the role if he was like sober.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And then you have, but then you just have like Ryder just beat the shit out of him. I would pay to see him get the shit beat out of him.
Yeah,
I could see. You know, if they went ahead with something like that, like I could see the guys in the mid card, like this WrestleMania of all WrestleManias, of how pissed you would be that here is, you know, we work all year and the biggest show of the year, it's going to be Rock, Hunter, Undertaker, you know, Situation.
I don't buy that.
And if you want the mid card in WWE to be happy, just do away with testing for marijuana. They won't care. They won't care that they're losing their spot. They'll all be smoking weed.
I'm amazed they test for pot in that country.
I am. So am I. I am
well,
shocked.
Give me the one thing holding Rob Van Dam from going back there.
It's an illegal substance. That's what I wonder. I wonder. Well, but it's an illegal substance that, you know, at this point, it's doing them way more harm than good.
I know. And you know, we've argued about
if you're going to three strike, marijuana. Is spice going to be a three strike thing now? Because like you're going to have
do they test for
it's,
that?
It's part of they test for spice now.
Pot is not considered a wellness violation. I believe it's a fine that you get.
I would have been
spice though. No, spice I think is part of it because that's what our truth got popped.
Yeah, they was and just, Evan Bourne.
That's yeah, legal, it's isn't actually it? Better it for is you legal. To just get caught with pot and then it's a fine.
Hey, hold on, but isn't one product is legal, but the other isn't?
No, pot is a. I thought it was a wellness. I thought you got suspended for it because when they busted Sabu. And
they were holding
me. I think at that point.
Oh, but they got a charge for me from the police.
Yeah, they also had like.
I thought it was just
lot.
Weed.
Oh, they had like pills and stuff in the car, I think, or something. Yeah, I can't remember. I don't want to assume. But I think pot right now is just the fine, and stuff like spice is what you get suspended for because there have been numerous pot busts for guys who they're simply fine.
But spice is still legal. Right, like that's the thing. You can buy it like
a head shop.
At head shops. You go to the head shops, and they're like, it is crazy expensive. But I guess you're a pro wrestler, so you can afford it. But it's like, and it's probably way worse for you than the marijuana that you're smoking. Yeah.
My issue with pot being banned is that I think it's just like these guys. It's like, okay, well, what else are they going to, you know?
Oh, it's maddening on the road. Like that's,
to me, it's just going to increase alcohol use, and then you're getting into a lot more. Bigger problems than guys simply going back to their hotel and having a joint after the show.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the parallels between being a touring indie musician and being a touring wrestler, I think, are pretty close. And especially, there's just so much time. Like, you know, you only work for 2 hours a day, and the rest of you are sitting around waiting to do your job.
Yeah,
and
what do you do?
What do you do? And there's booze.
Drink and tweet.
Drink and tweet. You know, like, yeah, like I think WWE. I know Vince McMahon has a personal issue against marijuana, but I just think it's going to be something that is going to they're going to keep running into.
The thing is, though, they are a public company, and with that reputation, are there any companies that don't test for marijuana? Any professional athletic companies?
I guarantee you. Oh, maybe not professional. Oh, athletic companies?
Yeah.
Oh, NFL, I'm sure doesn't.
Oh, they don't.
I'm sure. Oh, well, I'm sorry, my phone. I'm sure they're not because, like, couldn't you imagine, like, you would have NFL players busted all the time for smoking weed. Basketball, too, because I know NBA, well, I don't know, but I know a lot of rappers boast about smoking pot with NBA players. So, you know, I can't imagine them testing for marijuana for that thing. Like, you know, I there's a lot of publicly traded companies that I'm sure don't. I know MTV, Viacom doesn't. And stuff.
Yeah, all those sports leagues too. They also have labor unions where your testing is somewhat. It's not going to be the company that can just snap their fingers and test you. It's you know, you have to go through an entire union here, which you're never going to see in wrestling with these guys who can say, listen, you're not going to be withdrawing blood from me. That's been the whole holdup in all these other sports to test for like growth hormone. It's like you're not withdrawing blood from these athletes that are part of our union.
Huh.
And that with WWE for any of these non-unionized organizations, they can do whatever they want. That's what they can do with all these commissions with MMA fighters. They can test them whenever they want because they have no representation.
But can they test them in MMA whenever they want? Because isn't there like guys that
in Nevada the commission has to pass a law to be able to do it. But Nevada is the only one they can show up at your doorstep and test you whenever without warning. But The problem with that is the way they do it is that, okay, Wei Ting is fighting in 6 weeks. We're going to come and test you in 48 hours. And it's like when you give guys a heads up of when they're going to be tested, it's like it really comes down to an IQ test.
Well, how long does it take to you know, get steroids out of your system or some illegal substance out of your system?
If it's depends what the substance is.
But if it's more than 48 hours, then, you know, it shouldn't make a difference.
Well, I guess that's why so many fighters probably shave their heads. Because that's one of the big tests is the hair test.
That's what it did.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because a hair test, you can't clean your blood and your hair shows
Oh, wow.
As long as your hair is. cool. how what you've done. Yeah. Nice. So that's what.
That's why you're bald.
It's one of the main reasons. Yeah. Shave my beard. Police come up to the van. Shave my beard.
Much music testing.
Shaving. Yeah, the much music testing. Yeah. The stringent fucked up testing. We have a really strict drug policy in fucked up. It is a militant policy that I'm trying to fight against with my union.
So the WWF guys in the 80s used to do is when they found out there was a. They would start testing for coke, and the guys would just be downing vinegar and shit.
Oh, really? Would that clean them out? Oh.
I don't even know if that's a legit way to get it out of your system, or if that's just some, you know, urban legend. Yeah.
Could only imagine, like, being in that locker room, like, in the 80s, dude. Like, they're all, like, juiced up, like, drink the vinegar! Drink that white vinegar, brother!
The 80s WWF scene, to me, it's like...
terrifying.
To be able to walk through that locker room just for one day... I mean, just between the crazy personalities you had in there, where 80% of them were probably fucked.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what a scene. That's what I always ask Corderas about. I was like, man, what were the 80s like, dude? You guys are on the road like 60 days at a time.
Jimmy's the craziest
multiple
one.
Multiple cities.
Yeah.
And Corderas is like the most normal human being I've ever met. To come out of that environment intact is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, but some of these guys, it's like, holy shit, how are they alive today? A lot of them aren't.
Yeah. And that's probably why a lot of them aren't at this point.
So, another happy note to segue us into the Rumble. 45 minutes in here.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So, the Rumble, Providence, Rhode Island, from the Civic Center. Little fact, it is now known as the Dunkin' Donuts Center. The prestigious Dunkin' Donuts Center.
Wow.
It doesn't have the ring of Madison Square Garden.
No, does not. Not.
Which I just saw for the first time, actually.
MSG?
On this trip, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just had some free time at the bus station, and, like, Madison Square Garden's, like, up the street from Penn Station, so I just walked up, and not much going on.
Yeah. I went to WrestleMania 20 there.
You did, yeah.
Yep.
I've never been. I've walked out. I've been outside of it, but I've never...
They've done a whole bunch of renovations.
I don't think we could play MSG.
You will play MSG one day, I'm sure.
We would have to be opening for someone. It was funny, because we did that tour with Tenacious D and the Foo Fighters, and Tenacious D played there one time, and they had Neil Hamburger open for them.
Oh, wow.
And they said, seeing 15,000 people... boo someone.
That's awesome.
And then they start throwing change at him.
Oh, shit.
And he finishes his set.
Oh, that's great.
And then makes everyone wait while he picked up every single piece of change and put
man.
It in his pocket.
What a worker.
Yeah.
Neil Hamburger is like my favorite Twitter guy
in
the world.
He is a brilliant worker. A brilliant worker. Like, awesome. Most people would get up there in front of that many people and they'd have to break character.
That is hilarious.
He's done the comedy bar before.
Yeah, he has.
Yeah, he did the comedy bar, and he's actually one of the people performing on that cruise that we're playing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to that aspect of it. Because he also, oh my gosh, the digressions here are ridiculous, but he also used to run a really cool art noise label.
Yeah.
At one point.
That was his background, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was music.
Yeah, music. And I forget the group he was in, but he put out, like, White House CDs and all these, like, really dark power electronic type things. And now he's Neil Hamburger.
It's amazing.
Quickly, before this is the last tangent, I just want to ask you about, there is this death metal band out of, like, I want to say Germany. And it was, like, it was fucked. You have to have known this story. It was, like, the band member, one of them, like, killed a member of the band.
Norway.
And
it's Norwegian black metal.
And then they took a picture and then used it on the CD.
No, there's two stories. They're, in Norway, their death metal kind of hit a point, and these guys that were... in this band called Mayhem, we're like, we want to become the most dark, evil band of all time. Like way more, like, because they were sick and tired of seeing all the death metal dudes that would just wear jeans and stuff and t-shirts and drink beer. They wanted to make it, like, evil. And so they formed this thing called the Satanic Circle, I believe it was what they called it. And the lead singer of this band, Death, blew his own brains out, like, with a shotgun. And Euronymous came home, the guitar player, and found him there. And before he called the police, he cooked part of his brain and ate it so he could be a cannibal.
Okay, didn't hear that.
And then took the bits of his skull and made necklaces out of him.
He's in prison now, isn't he?
Then it goes on. Yeah, he then gets murdered by this guy, Varg. Euronymous got stabbed to death by this guy.
Bard. A real story, or is this like Thor?
It's real.
This is legit,
yeah.
Dude.
And he plays. And he plays
Norway, man.
This guy Varg, who's a neo-Nazi, terrible, terrible dude, went to jail for murdering Euronymous. Got out recently because in Norway you get like 15 years. He got out recently and he's full on white power now. And he's gotten his band back together. They're called Burzum.
And that's it, Burzum.
Burzum, yes. And they're touring, and yeah, that's Norway. But they also start burning churches because Norway has these famous wooden churches, and these a lot of these kids were obsessed with the idea of Christianity being an invading force on Norwegian culture, and that's how it became got so tied into the neo-Nazi thing, is because the neo-Nazis kind of. It was like a Norwegian pride, like taking Norway back for Norwegians, and that's how it kind of tied in with the black metal thing.
Sounds like these are just twisted people using music.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's a band, one of the coolest though black metal bands is from Vancouver. They're called Blasphemy, and they're a band with black and white members. They're skinheads that are militantly anti-fascist. Black metal dudes. So they all wear the corpse paint, but they have shaved heads and wear urban camo and like worship Satan, but fight and try and kill Nazis. And allegedly all sorts of crazy things. But
sounds awesome.
Yeah.
These gimmicks are more colorful than pro wrestling.
I know. That's the thing, right? This is how much do these two worlds cross over to one another?
Well, that Alex Wright character got right into like that, that neo-Nazi territory. They had to hold back. Some of those vignettes never got to air. It was Dusty Rhodes who produced those. Berlin. Remember Berlin with a Y?
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, we can't air this. This is like really out there shit where...
You know what, though? I kind of think that's way less offensive than when you have the babyface say something incredibly racist to a heel because the heel...
What are you
heel...
talking about, wrestling?
Yeah, like, no, it never happens. But like, you know, like that, like at least with Berlin, you have a guy who's going to be a heel and people are going to boo him and he's a neo-Nazi, but you're saying his values are wrong. And his values are bad, and this is why you shouldn't like this person. But there's characters that you're like cheering for, and it's like we're gonna kick you and send you back to where you came from. Like I forget who it was that told Alberto Del Rio that he was gonna send him back to Mexico, like recently,
or James Storm telling Mexican America, you know,
go back to your country and stuff. And it's like that's
One of them too. I was like, I'm gonna have you like cut my lawns. And
yeah.
Like,
well, WWE does a pretty bang up job.
Remember when Mexicals they came out on
and I was like, I remember watching it, and that was kind of like around the time I'm super getting into it, so I knew all these guys from their amazing work they had done in ECW and even WCW, and then here they bring them out like the first day and then they turn them into gardeners.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh my
god, you get into their thinking and like they're probably thinking, how do we identify these guys with our audience? Like, how do we make them relate to the common fan?
It's like, because I guess Vince McMahon in his day-to-day life probably does not run into a lot of Latino people, and he
except for cutting his lawn,
his gardeners, obviously now criminals. Because there's a Latino criminal gang that is somehow migrated from WWE. There's like a Latino gang invasion in all of wrestling right now. Mexican America and TNA and the new faction in WWE that's forming.
Yeah, we got Junico and Camacho.
Doing the exact same gimmick.
Yeah, identical.
Well, what else can they do?
That's true.
Except form a gang.
Except form a gang or cut the lawn. The most racist company in the world.
Vince McMahon, oh my god.
Yeah.
Just trying to think of what he could do next with further divide the white audience from...
Maybe have a Hispanic guy dress up as an Asian character. Or a Samoan dress up as an Asian character.
Well, he's done that.
Yeah.
He's done that.
On this show.
He's done that, you know.
Did you guys read this past week how Rick Santorum used to be a lobbyist for the WWF in the mid-80s?
Yeah, I did hear that, the WWF connection and stuff.
Rick Santorum. Oh, who's that? I would say Google him, but don't Google Santorum.
Yeah.
This guy is like the most fucked up right-wing politician to the point that people have given the term Santorum now. They define Santorum because he just hates gay people. This is a guy who just a few years ago said that homosexuality is a slippery slope away from bestiality.
And
this guy is now a front runner for the Republicans.
But you think, like, you know what? And you're like, he's terrifying, he's scary. He is the most terrifying, scary person on the Republican ticket other than the rest of the people standing beside him.
Newt Gingrich,
like Ron Paul. Like, it's just like, you know, it's like, oh my God, this is crazy. Like, I would, Linda McMahon would get my vote if I was in America right now and she came out as a dark horse candidate in the Republican primary. Because it is terrifying. Like, the only good thing about it is it is hopefully, knock on wood, it's going to be a cakewalk for Obama. Because it's going to be like, yeah, like, you know, you can say what you want about Obamacare. You can say what you want about the death panels. But at least I'm not crazy like this neo-Nazi dude beside me who's the Republican candidate.
I'm not kidding, Wei, when I say this. I think this year when Linda's running and it's the night of the presidential election, we should do a podcast. Because
totally.
The last yeah. time Linda was running, I was watching CNN, and they start showing footage of Jim Ross getting kicked in the balls. They go to the political panel. All these panelists discussing Jim Ross and Linda McMahon. And I was like, this is fucked. And this is, and you watch this. It's like, there is not that far a crossover here from one to the other, man. It's just, it's fucking politicians cutting promos.
It is.
And yeah. it's just, it's amazing.
Oh, it is. It's all pro wrestling. It's all like... It's all promos. It's everyone playing the heel or trying to be babyface.
But everybody's a mark, and people don't understand that they're promos.
Yeah.
You know?
No. Back to wrestling.
The Rumble, 94. All right. Show starts off with Vince McMahon all by his lonesome on the old announcer's podium by the away from the ring. And he
I want to talk about the music at the very, very beginning. This is like... You know, as much as I hate hearing a Saliva song or this, that stuff will date it, but nothing dates it like this opening sequence for this show, where it's like that synthesizer kind of canned. It sounds like the theme song for the Larry Sanders Show.
The classic, like Rumble theme.
Yeah, the Rumble theme music.
I will disagree. I love that theme. I think it's total nostalgia.
Yeah.
Great.
And, you know, someday we'll be nostalgic for Saliva, perhaps.
It's going to be a drowning. cold day.
This is when music was music.
It's like 1965 all over again, you know? Yeah.
It's one of the worst parts about being a kid is that eventually you're going to grow up and nostalgia is going to remain in your head and you're going to be like a grown person defending bullshit. Like in 25 years, people are going to be like, wrestling sucks today, man. Back when John Cena was a headliner and they had real women like Kelly Kelly who, you know, screamed and hit the ropes like champions. Not like these Barbie dolls today. Yeah, what's it going to sound like?
It's going to have to be so bad in the future. Like, it's going to have to be, like, one move. Like, the champion will have one move in his move set. Like, he'll just come out and do his finisher, and oh, he'll get knocked out, get up from anything, and then do his finisher.
Nostalgia makes even shit look fine.
That's true.
It really does.
That's true. Well, last week when you guys were doing the Attitude Era, you know, like
that, or
2 weeks ago.
Era, sometimes it's the reverse effect. I think it's worse than I remembered.
Sometimes
I'm saying. Like, there's some stuff on there that's terrible.
Yeah.
Like, terrible, terrible, terrible. And there's some stuff on this, which I kind of like, because I was a casual fan during this period, that I did not remember how amazing it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some stuff on this that I thought was really good.
Yeah, likewise.
So Ted DiBiase comes out as the color commentator for Vince McMahon. This was when Jerry Lawler was on hiatus after a woman had alleged that she had been raped and then admitted, okay, I made it up.
Wow.
And then, but Lawler was taken off TV for a while here. And DiBiase says that the WWF paid him more than John Madden was paid by Fox to jump over, which was $30 million over 4 years. Questionable figure. And they announced that Ludwig Borga has been injured, and he'll be replaced by Bam Bam Bigelow.
I like how Vince McMahon. I like Vince McMahon laughs at Ted DiBiase's comment. Like, he goes, that would be weird. Well, I forget. I've got it actually written down here. It's like, you working for me, and he's like, that's a laugh.
Vince McMahon was, whether you love or hate this guy, he was a great announcer.
Oh, great announcer.
Just so,
a really good announcer.
Like, every stereotype of a wrestling announcer was present in this man.
Yeah. And he, like, he loved to laugh.
Yeah.
And he loved to yell. Like, he was just a loud man.
He's great, man. Like, and it goes to, it's the same deal with the music. For me, listening to Vince's commentary is total nostalgia for this period. Because I mean, I sometimes think if Vince wasn't Vince, if Vince wasn't the owner, if Vince wasn't the character, if he was just the announcer, if we only knew him as the announcer, how would we look back at him?
Well, when he calls the match, to me, he kind of is like a Booker T. Like, definitely a little more
refined
than Booker T, and you can understand him a little more than Booker T, but he's definitely like someone that, you know, he's definitely not a JR, like someone who's like legit calling the match as best as he can and, like, you know, calling the moves and getting excited at the right points. He's like a Booker T and someone that's just like, he just buys everything. Like, you would think he's never seen a wrestling match in his entire life. Like,
yeah. I thought, to me, the big, when he was exposed the most, it was when Taka Michinoku came in and suddenly he's doing this, what a maneuver.
What a maneuver.
Like, he was just lost here. Jim Ross had to do like the heavy lifting there in the match. Like, Vince really doesn't know what the fuck he's calling here at all. But anyway, we digress. Tatanka against Bam Bam Bigelow, who's accompanied by Luna Vachon. What a start to this. Tatanka, who's still running strong here in 2012, doing indie shows.
Oh, wow, okay. Is he? Is he still undefeated?
No,
he wasn't undefeated at this point. They
Ludwig
said,
Borga had Ludwig Borga had ended the streak, and then Borga not around here.
Got injured, so Bam Bam had to pick up. I love Bam Bam. Bam Bam's like one of those characters.
Bam Bam Bigelow was always one of my favorites.
Me too.
And just the fact what this guy could do at that size.
And he's passed away, right? Him and Luna both, right? So, but I thought him with Luna was great too, right?
And his music at this time was awesome.
Oh, awesome.
Bam, 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 bam.
I even put that together, Luna and Bam Bam. There were quite a few casualties on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, fuck. Ludwig Borga died
That's
too.
That's true.
Oh, depressing. Tatanka attacks Bigelow right out of the gate, misses a crossbody off the top, and then begins selling. They mentioned that both are going to be in the Rumble later tonight, which was an indication of how thin this roster was. You guys are doing double duty tonight. Tatanka goes for a sunset flip, but Bigelow sits right on top of him. And then Bigelow applied a bear hug for approximately 9 hours. Worked over the lower ribs, and they were mentioning here that Ludwig Borga had injured those ribs. And then Tatanka fights out, takes two shoulder blocks, and then hits a power slam. Bigelow regained the advantage, misses a moonsault off the top, and then Tatanka with a cross body right off the top rope for the win. 8 minutes and 12 seconds this one went. Just kind of there.
Kind of
impressive Bigelow did a moonsault.
Yeah, I don't know if he's ever hit that moonsault.
It's like the flare bump off the top.
Yeah. I thought Tatanka and Bam Bam were both fantastic. It was like both like a good match, and like Tatanka is like, you know, as ridiculous as everything about Tatanka seems, he is a good baby face. Mm-hmm. You know, like you get behind him you know, especially when he was, I liked when he was doing like sort of the dance, and he was and then Bam Bam knocks him down.
It was
then,
his version of hulking up.
Hulking up, yeah. Like he does the hulking up dance, and then he gets taken out by Bam Bam, who then does the racist imitation of the dance. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of like a heel and a baby face. This is like really obvious that comes across in the match.
Yeah, I thought they did a very good job of playing a typical underdog and monster type of match.
Natives in wrestling were what natives in the 90s were what Muslims were in the 2000s in pro wrestling.
I think Aboriginal peoples from all over the world, because you have the head shrinkers.
And it was worse because usually the natives were like Tatanka. I mean, they were all baby faces, and yet they got just the most stereotypical. Okay, well, here's your axe. let's spray paint your hair. And you can dance, right? You Indians dance,
you can
right?
Skip, right?
Don't call me an Indian. Oh, you're an Indian. God damn it. They replay an angle from the Survivor Series with the Hart family against Shawn Michaels and showing how Brett was eliminated during the match. And they kind of recap all what was going on with Bret and Owen at the time. A week after the Survivor Series, Vince McMahon interviews Owen Hart about being in the shadow of Bret, and Owen challenges him to a match. And then the following week, Bret turns down the challenge. And then, over the Christmas holidays, much like Devon and his children, they reconciled. And Owen says that he said some things he shouldn't have. And he made this one subtle line. He's like, I said some things I shouldn't have. Doesn't matter if they were true or not. and then just goes on. It was just that little
line.
He
kept going
there.
He kept saying, like, and this is going to be a great year with the Rocket and the Hitman behind him. The Hitman behind him.
Yeah.
He kept saying behind him.
Yeah.
Like, Owen Hart's, like, I think the wrestler that I really, for myself.
I thought he was the star of this entire event.
I just discovered him this year. Like, I really did not appreciate him at all until this year, and I just cannot believe how amazing he is. In and out of the ring. Like,
and this just, program was just, it was so great.
So good.
Like,
so
they knew where they were. Like, look at this. Going back to the Survivor Series in November,
yeah.
They knew where they were going till WrestleMania, and you were able to book backwards here. And just, I love when you can throw in little subtle things that have a payoff way down the road, and you can easily go back. It makes perfect sense. These little subtle hints from Owen without giving anything away. I just thought this promo leading up to this match, it was great.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, has there ever been a good brother versus brother feud except for this one?
Better than this one?
Better than this one or as good as this one? Like, because all I can think of is when they do them badly.
Yeah, I can't think of...
Because this is like, yeah, how to do
not
a family.
Not in recent memory. I don't know.
The Hardys have always failed.
Always and failed.
Edge and both Christian times they've tried. Edge and Christian was
Edge and Christian
way
not.
Too short. And
what about when the British Bulldogs broke up? Was there any sort of...
I can't even remember
when that feud happened.
That wasn't even like...
was that not even on TV?
That was like legit. Because they had left the WWF and they were in Stampede. And I guess... Billington was injured or something like that, so Davey went to All Japan for the year-end tournament, and he brought Johnny Smith with him, and they went as the new Bulldogs, and that was it. And Billington just hated him after that.
And they couldn't really do the brother thing
out
there. But yeah, I don't know, maybe not in recent
memory. Those two, it was like legit hatred. Billington was like, if I ever get to fight him, he just hated Davey.
Nope. Yeah, Frank and Ken Shamrock. Maybe.
Frank and Ken.
Yeah.
That was their plan till Ken fucked stuff up. They were going to do that fight. And then Showtime wanted nothing to do with Ken after the Kimbo fiasco.
Yeah.
It's tough to do brother versus brother.
It is.
All right. From there, where were we here? They do the babyface promo. They're going to face the Quebecers. And then they show highlights from Raw a few weeks back where the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty win the tag titles from the Quebecers on Raw, but then lost them a week later at a house show in Madison Square Garden.
What happened there?
I have no clue. Other than maybe they want to do something, do a title change on TV because Raw was, you know, just in its infancy, and maybe do a title change at a Madison Square Garden house show, which was, you know, they probably weren't selling out Madison Square Garden at this point because they didn't have fucked up on the bill.
They have fucked up on the bill. Like, WWE, if you're listening, we'll help you fill those seats.
Yeah, this was like a today booking. Let's just flip the titles.
That's what I was thinking.
Twice in a week. I was like, they never did this shit back then.
And when they do stuff on a house show, normally it's because someone got in trouble or someone did something bad and they can't have the titles on them anymore.
Yeah. So I believe the house show was like the night before this event. So you were...
This is like today. There's no lead up to the
you wouldn't even know it was going to be a tag title match until you tuned in. It's not like you were on the internet reading Madison Square Garden results at that point. Maybe you were calling a
hotline.
900 hotline paying $3.99 a minute.
I need to know what's going on for the tag team.
Starphone and Norm DaCosta. Yeah. Todd Pettengill is with Bret and Owen in the back. They say they're going to win the titles tonight, and they will be fighting champions and give title shots to all of the teams, including the Steiner brothers. And that leads us to the Quebecers with Johnny Polo, later Raven.
Raven.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How old is he?
At this point, he must 46.
At this point?
Late 40s, I'm guessing.
Wow, already, huh?
Yeah, I think he's...
So when he had his ECW run, you're saying he was in his...
Early 30s.
Okay, yeah, so 30s, not 40s.
I'm saying today he's in his late 40s.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't 46 at this point. I thought you said how old is he now? I would guess at this point, early 30s.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Okay.
Cool. This was post Scotty Flamingo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he's been around forever.
Yeah.
His gimmick was a putter, a golf putter.
Well, if you're a heel manager, you got to have
sporting equipment.
You can't have the tennis racket. Yeah. You got to have something. Whistle if you're Alfonso.
Brett and Owen come out, and as the match begins, Vince says Brett and Owen are the best tag team combination ever. in their first match.
He's got a lot of credibility as an announcer.
Yeah, clearly.
Well, and also at this point, you know, I'd be trying to get them over because Bret Hart's going to be your main babyface.
The Harts get the advantage early on, and Owen was just his speed. Like, he just looked great in this match.
So good.
There were some sloppy parts, though, with him and Jacques at the top. I felt like they were off mark at some points. So a bunch of missed drop kicks with the two of them. That's just me, though.
Was that the part where they went for, like, the double drop kick?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was deliberate, no?
I don't think they were double drop kicks. I think it was just, like, Owen drop kicking Jacques. But, I mean, I could be wrong.
The Quebecers got the heat on Bret. They wore him down in their corner. Pierre starts choking him while Owen tries to run in. Fans start chanting Owen Hart. Vince says that Bret and Owen, they have to be the tag champions. They deserve to be the tag champions. Just the model of impartiality here from Vince. Owen gets the hot tag, runs in, belly-to-belly suplex, spinning heel kick, and then applies the sharpshooter to Jacques, but then Pierre breaks it up. We fast forward, and with the ref's back turned, Bret runs into the ropes, Johnny Polo pulls down the top rope, and Bret spills onto the floor, and he starts selling his left knee. And this is where Jacques attacked the knee with a chair. Like a legit, not the fold-up chair.
Yeah, like
the one with the legs
plastic
to it.
Metal leg.
Yeah, Jacques wasn't fucking around here. Then attacks him with the golf putter. And this might have been the longest count in history, as Bret was on the floor for like 5 minutes, legit, and got in at the count of nine.
They both were saying, like, this count is taking forever.
And then Owen finally sends him into the ring. Quebecers are making frequent tags. They're all working over the knee. And then they go for their finish, which was Pierre getting sprung. It was like the most weird-looking
finish.
It's a
goofy-looking finish.
It's so goofy. Like, Pierre stands on the top. They clasp hands and then does, like, a senton off the top landing. It's just, like, so funny-looking of a move. I don't even know if they had a name for it. They miss as Bret gets out of the way, and DiBiase's calling from tag Owen, and Owen is just tag me, but Bret, rather than going for the tag, he's able to apply the sharpshooter, but then lets go of it, and cannot hold on, and the ref calls for the finish at 16 minutes and 47 seconds because of Bret's condition, a referee stoppage via injury.
I thought this match told a great story. It felt like they hit their storyline points really well. For me, like, the finish felt like it could have been better if it was more conclusive. Like, I felt finishes like these were pretty... It just... There's no precedent set for
yeah, the
stopping.
Fans don't... You're not educated to react to ref stoppages in a match.
And I think they could have achieved the whatever storyline points they were trying to hit, you know, even if they had Bret lose or if they had Owen
lose. I think
lose.
They didn't want to pin Bret.
And yeah, like
they had to lose, and Bret had to lose the match for them, and they just didn't want to beat Bret, I guess.
I understand.
And Bret has to be injured, I think, to let his brother down. You know,
yeah,
like Bret had
sure.
to be like, when he left, he was because he was.
You could have still, you know, achieved that.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, it's a minor point. I thought, obviously, the star of this match was Owen, as well as Bret for selling. I thought his selling has always been
tremendous.
He was
great.
Him here, like, basically just selling like he's been stabbed the entire time. I think about this performance, and I think about the performance when he was from Survivor Series, like, the next year against, or was it this year, against Backlund?
That was later that year.
Yeah, in the match against Backlund for the title, where Owen was on the outside throwing the towel in, you just feel like legit pain for this guy.
Yeah,
you know, with the way he looks, it's just the perfect amount of facials for wrestling, not too much and not too little. So, yeah.
I thought the match told a really good story. It was like, and you could totally have a legitimate issue here with Owen being pissed here. He wanted to win his first title, and Bret didn't make the tag, and the post-match was the strongest part, I thought. Owen is yelling at Bret, and Bret is fighting to get to his feet on his bad knee, and he finally gets up, and the visual that everyone remembers from the show, Owen kicks the bad knee, and Bret just lands on his back, and the arena just boos the shit out of Owen Hart here, and Owen just coming down the ramp, yelling at the camera, calling him selfish. Why are you so selfish, Bret? All you had to do was tag me.
Awesome.
I was getting so good here.
Except Ted DiBiase was doing his ha 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 every 30 seconds. And it's just getting so annoying because you're watching this. It's like, you know, I guess announcing ruined shit back then, too. You know, like, but yeah, no, amazing, amazing. And he, like, Owen just one of those people that immediately turned everyone in that crowd to hate him.
Bunch of officials come out to check on Brett, including Pat Patterson and Billy Red Lions. Quite the cameo there on this show. And then, as great as Owen was, Ray Rougeau was equally bad.
Is that Jacques' brother?
Yes.
That, I was like...
What a conflict of interest here.
What a conflict of interest. What a conflict of interest.
Ray Rougeau, I never remember this guy being horrible, but he was just terrible. He gets in, hey, we just want to talk to him. He was so annoying,
so annoying
here. Oh, I couldn't stand Ray Rougeau here. So we go to the back, and Todd Pettengill is with Owen Hart, and he calls Brett selfish, says he cost him the biggest match of his career. Your ego is too big.
Yeah.
And they're playing this on the big screen as Brett is watching his brother yell at him on the screen as he is stretchered out.
Yeah.
And the infamous line, and that's why I kicked your leg out of your leg. And Owen just stepped back. He's like, fuck. Fuck, I messed up the promo.
He was also flubbing lines in the pre-fight promo too, where he with him and Brett did that, he was just like, you know, flubbing a lot of things, a little mush mouth, you know.
He's a little prone to that, like,
but he's so good when he gets angry.
It doesn't matter,
you know?
Because like, I thought Owen just played the perfect character for Owen Hart, because he looks like a jealous little brother. Like, contrast his look with Bret Hart's. I mean, here's a guy with, you know, bleach blonde hair, and just has like a...
He's kind of chubby. Even though he's not chubby, he always looks like this fatter younger brother.
And his face, like, especially when he frowns...
As a fatter older brother.
Especially when he frowns, he just like looks like just... You know, just like a little kid. He looks like a little jealous kid of his older brother. He's whiny. He's overly emotional. Again, a complete contrast against Brett. And, you know, he looks the part, plays the part perfectly.
Yeah, and the original plan for this, of course, was Bruce Hart for this role. And that's what Pat Patterson wanted, and that was their direction. And Brett was the one who vetoed it, saying, no, it should be Owen. And I can't disagree with that decision. I just couldn't see Bruce in this role of being... Like, I think it would have been completely different.
It'd be a different character.
You have the age difference where Bruce is the older one. Yeah. I mean, you'd almost have to play like the angry old veteran pissed about his younger brother's success. Yeah. I just don't know if it would have worked. And that was Brett's call. And that led to big problems with Bruce and Brett, where Bruce felt that was his big break and Brett cost it for him. So that's... Anyway, another day for another Hart family squabble.
I love this feud. I thought it did as much, honestly, for Brett as it did for Owen, because Brett, coming off of a title win, a title run, like, he needed something to kind of push him off to that next level. That's not that wasn't necessarily a title run, and I thought this was a perfect thing because the story was strong, and it shows that, you know, you don't need titles in order to push guys in your main event.
DiBiase applauds Owen afterwards, explains you have to step on people and be cutthroat to be successful. And the heel turn is complete for Owen. And then we go to our next matchup. How do you follow that great segment? With Razor Ramon and IRS.
Yeah, this is where the show...
Continental title.
Show took a little bit of a slower turn for the next couple.
This is this is the kind of match that maybe Jeff Jarrett watched in 2001 and said, hey, we can make a promotion built around shit like this.
But the thing is, though, like...
With these guys.
But the thing is, like, for me, I was just so happy to see these gimmicks come out. For me, like, it's like these are my favorite characters or my favorite TV show, you know, making an appearance. So, like, you know, just hearing Razor come out in his music, seeing IRS come out cutting a promo on the crowd for not paying their taxes, like, it reminds me of my childhood. And so,
well, I had zero nostalgia for this, because as soon as Razor Ramon came out, all I could think of was that E60 piece. Because that's, like, the highlights they use of Razor Ramon in his heyday.
This was Razor at his peak.
Yeah. Why did he never get a main event? Because he left, I guess? Did he never get a...
Yeah, he was just... I mean, the guy was over, but I don't know. Even when I was a kid, I never saw him as, you know, top guy.
Well, I guess you could never really have him drop the street thug kind of, like, gimmick. completely?
To me, like, he was always kind of caught somewhere in between, because he wasn't a great worker like Sean or
Brett. Yeah, that's true.
And he wasn't a monster like Nash. So he was always like kind of stuck in that mid, you know, mid card, upper mid card level.
Had a great look, really good promos, but you know, never
the top guy.
It's not like was put in a position really to be a top draw, but just didn't seem to be
well even
that
WC-
low. And that was back at a time when it was like, you know, very few guys got that top title. Whereas today, it's like, I'm sure this guy would have got a run today with all the world titles and how many changes they do. But back then, it was like, you know, it's a very select few guys that we're going to put in that top position.
Yeah.
IRS does a promo on the way to the ring calling everyone tax cheats. And this was actually called by Jim Ross and Gorilla Monsoon, who were working for Radio WWF at the time.
I needed a break from Ted DiBiase.
You really did not enjoy him on this.
No, I was like, I was like, I actually wrote my notes like, I really am getting sick of Ted DiBiase. And then, you know, luckily, here comes the Gorilla and JR.
What was this? Was this just to promote the radio?
Oh, they launched, I think it was just like an arrangement with another radio station. And they would call pay-per-views. And I think Jim Ross did like a call-in show.
So they call pay-per-views at the same time as the other set of commentators?
Yeah, I don't know how. I think it was free. Like, you never got it up here in Canada. Huh. I don't really know all the behind the scenes.
I can't imagine just listening to a wrestling match. Like, I've never tried that before.
Oh, well, I listen to people recap them.
Yeah, you know? But I mean, listening to a play-by-play,
that's
like
true,
you listen
that's
to a
true.
Baseball game.
That well, used to be the old way of how you got around pay-per-view. It was like you could listen to
and,
it.
And people used to listen to wrestling.
All static.
And people used to listen to wrestling all the time on radio, you know, prior to wrestling kind of transferring over to TV. But I could, if it was Gorilla Monsoon and JR calling, I could listen to it.
I'd be interested, yeah.
You know, if it was Cole and Josh Matthews, I might not be.
Listen, it could probably make the product a lot better at times.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I think. Imagine today, like, listening to the commentary of where they go off on the – where Cole's just not even acknowledging the match and talking about stuff. Imagine you didn't have the visual there of how disconnected
what am I
the commentary
watching?
Really is.
Well, like, I'm sure there are blind viewers out there that only have commentary to go by.
Yeah.
How do they want – what do they think of the show?
No, they probably have descriptive video. Right, where someone's
running at the same time as commentary.
No, hopefully they just turn the commentary off. Hopefully they don't have the system.
Where's
the
that feed? Where can I get that?
I got to find that too.
The match begins. Razor just hits him with a series of punches, sends IRS to the floor. Crowd was really into Razor on offense here at the start of the match. IRS finally stops him by throwing him over the top to the floor. Ramon is selling, makes his comeback with a bunch of punches, fallaway slam. Then the official gets knocked out. Ramon catches IRS, who has a briefcase, and he knocks IRS in the face, but the official is still out. Ramon then hits his back suplex off the top. He calls for the Razor's Edge, but as he goes for it, Shawn Michaels does a run-in and attacks Ramon with his version of the Intercontinental title, because there was the controversy over who was the real champion. And then IRS climbs over, covers Ramon for the win. Joey Morella calls for the three count. Everyone thinks IRS has won, but then Earl Hebner runs in, tells Joey Morella what happened, and he sees the two titles there, and all of a sudden, Ramon just hits IRS with the Razor's Edge and pins him. This was right out of TNA, this finish.
Yeah, it was a weird finish.
What a convoluted finish this was. I was not a fan.
Yeah, well, I was just excited. I saw the Razor's Edge.
Okay. Then we get a video of Yokozuna and The Undertaker. Yokozuna, as every opponent of the casket match would, scared of being put in boxes.
Yeah.
He had a fear of this.
And I don't want to be put in a box with a lock on it. It's like such a weird fear.
They actually put a camera inside of the casket to take us on a tour of this casket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would either one of you get into a casket, though?
Oh, I would, yeah.
Yeah, why not?
I don't know if I would. I don't know, something creepy about it.
Yeah, I can say, definitely he's creepy.
Maybe he's claustrophobic.
Yeah, well, you know, wasn't that the thing with Kamala?
Yeah, Kamala, Giant Gonzalez.
Yeah.
And I'm sure being Japanese, he's very spiritual and...
Well, of course.
It's a big taboo for him.
Based on my education from wrestling, they all throw salt and they're spiritual.
Yep. Yes. Exactly.
And they all listen to the same song.
Dun, 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 dun.
Their entrance.
Yeah. I wonder if WWE just labels these songs like generic Japanese wrestler, generic stereotypical like Asian wrestler, generic Mexican wrestler, generic
Asian sounds,
gang member Mexican
gongs.
Yeah.
They have a promo tape from Superstars with Jim Cornette, who signed the contract for the match, and when it came back, they had inserted the fine print about this being a casket match, and Jim Cornette was outraged at this this contract stipulation.
I would be too if I signed a contract and then someone changed it on me.
Wait a minute.
Imagine you're signing like a credit card contract.
I don't remember this being in there, but I guess it's legally binding.
Contract law by the World Wrestling Federation. Then on Superstars, they did an angle where Yokozuna opened up a casket and Undertaker was in the casket and he popped out. Surprise.
I thought it was amazing, though, how quickly Yokozuna got out of the ring. When Undertaker got out of that casket, he, like, scrambles out of that ring, and it looks so good.
Like a cat in 94, guy was.
Yeah.
This was right before the guy just ballooned out of... Like, the guy was big to begin with.
Yeah.
Just ballooned after this period. It was very sad. He was just to the point they couldn't use this guy anymore. Mm-hmm. No one would... certain states that commissioned wrestling wouldn't allow this guy. They wouldn't pass him.
Guys, this is going to sound really weird, and I don't think you guys have ever done this, at least that I've heard, but can we pause for a second so I can go to the bathroom?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, we've done this a lot.
Oh, do you?
Yokozuna and The Undertaker in a casket match for the WWF title, and it starts off with a face-to-face between the two. Undertaker drops him with a series of jumping clotheslines, and then Taker hits a chair shot to the back, and then to the head and shoulder, and this was with a... Again, the seated chair made its return with the four legs here. They love this chair.
Were they like just not using folding chairs at this time?
I guess not. I guess they had not realized the
benefits of that trope.
Yeah, of a flat object.
The real benefits, yeah. They're much easier on the skull.
Hey, yeah, we could hit each other in the head with these.
Yeah, man, that's awesome.
Did you guys see the Young Bucks defending chair shots?
No, what did they
say?
It's like, it causes as much...
He's like... Was it Nick Jackson? Yeah, it was Nick Jackson who said, you know, for all those dirt sheet writers who say the chair shots to the head hurt, well, here's a newsflash that every back bump, your head hits the mat. It's like, yeah, if you don't know how to bump, it bounces off the mat. And so these idiots defending chair shots to the head, like I'm just so annoyed.
Well, and also, it's not really the same thing unless the ground is coming towards your head, because in physics... It's the object with momentum striking a still object. Isn't the object with momentum have more force and have a greater impact on the still object than it does on...
We're not scientists.
I'll take your word for it.
I'm not a scientist either. Believe me. This is from some grade 10 hazily remembered science class that I'm trying to piece together.
Some guy actually, after the Ring of Honor pay-per-view, actually messaged me saying, how can you defend... The Briscoes using unprotected chair shots. I was like, dude, why don't you fucking listen to anything I've talked about in the last year? Like, I anger people because I feel like I talk about this subject too much. I've just stopped. I've given up.
Yeah, that's a nerve for John Pollock.
I don't care anymore. If guys want to hit each other in the head, that's fine.
Well, set
it's like,
off.
I just think it's so stupid.
John, you should not come to an old fucked up show. Like, now it's a little different, but I used to give myself some unprotected shots to the head.
With what?
A microphone, glass, bottles. That's why I've got all these scars up here. I got the roadmap.
Do the hard way blood.
I'm trying to look like D-Von Dudley. That's my fashion my fashion icon.
You're
for
a flaming table at a fucked up show.
I would love to. From Anti-Scene, Jeff Clayton has done bumps through a flaming table on their shows.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Like off a stage?
Just off the stage through a flaming table.
That's wild, man.
Yeah, like their shows look spectacular. Like, he's got the barbed wire baseball bat, and like there's all these, like, there's this fantastic book of them, and there's all these great photos with different wrestlers over the year. Madman Pondo and stuff.
Will we see the first casket match in a punk rock show?
Sorry, my dad's calling me. Sorry, can I take this?
Take the call
on the air.
Hey, Dad. Good, I'm sorry about that. I'm just doing a podcast. Give me a call in half an hour. That'd be perfect. Love you, Dad. Bye.
Dude, when it comes to anything artistic now, I think Louis C.K. is the new model.
Oh, yeah.
He does everything now. He writes, he edits, and he gives FX a finished product, and he has full creative control. And it's retarded successful. You hear about his special that he did a stand-up special.
Where you
and rather than sell it to, like, HBO or anything, he sold it for $5 on his site. He's made millions already, and he's donating, like, 20% of it to charity. Yeah. It's like, this guy is, like, on fire right now.
It's like the power of the internet, man.
That's it, man. It's
you don't need all the middlemen anymore.
I think more of these artists are going to realize it's like, no, fuck you. You guys need me a lot more than I need you at this point with the internet.
If that copyright law goes into effect, it's going to change a lot, I think.
What's the law?
The big law that they're going to push through that if they're worldwide pretty much.
That was SOPA?
Yeah.
They
they're going to be able to go to the...
They can regulate the internet and what you use.
You can get your IP address. They can get your IP address from your internet service provider.
Like, they can shut down our site because we'll, like, use a music, like a song on our podcast. Which, after watching that documentary you gave me, made me feel extremely guilty.
Yeah, we've used songs, and everybody does it.
Yeah, everyone does that, though. Like that's not... That's never going to put anyone out of business, you know? And the reason the record companies are caring so much more about that now is because they don't have the other money coming from sales.
I totally get the argument, though. If, like, someone were to say, hey, you used my song on your podcast.
Yeah.
It's like, but I saw a value to it, and I paid nothing for it. Yeah, I totally get the argument.
Yeah, I think so, too. But it would be like if you guys used a song as your theme song.
And, right.
But you're like, you promote the artist, and you play it at the very end. And it's normally a fade out, or it's normally you guys talking over the beginning of the song.
We don't really gain anything. Right? Like, no. In fact, we're promoting some
Yeah, exactly.
If we ever made money off this podcast, like, I wouldn't use music. I'd feel weird where it's like we're using music and we're profiting.
Yeah.
We make nothing off this. So.
It's a great area.
Anyway. By the way, have you seen that DVD, rip?
You guys were talking about it, and I haven't seen it yet. Is it on Netflix?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's an NFB documentary, so I don't know.
Oh, probably not. But you can probably watch it at the NFB.
Maybe.
Yeah. It's worth checking out. I enjoyed it a lot.
Have you ever seen any of those Ron Mann documentaries from NFB? He did Comic Book Confidential, a history.
I want to.
Phenomenal history of comic books.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing history of comic books. Cool. Like, starts with like Superman and goes right through interviews. It kind of goes like to what their, you know, cutting edge and Vanguard would have been at the time, which is like Frank Miller. But
cool.
But you know, it's like
what year was that?
Dark Knight Returns had just come out.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that 87, I guess, 86. Okay. But it's fantastic.
It's like a world that I'm still just discovering.
So yeah.
There's so much out there that I have to
so much stuff. There's so much. Well, that's I love documentaries because there is so much stuff. And it's documentaries like you can either have like a super interesting subject or a super well-done documentary, and either way, you're going to have a good documentary. Mm-hmm. And then when they're both out, it's fantastic.
That's got Netflix. There's some good shit on it.
Some great shit on it, I was really surprised documentary-wise, and I love news radio. That's one of my favorite TV shows.
Yeah. Rogan's got a special up there. They've got a bunch of documentaries.
But normally it's like $10?
$10.
Cheap, yeah.
$9.95
a month?
Yeah.
That's a bargain. Like,
but what video game system do you have?
I don't have any.
Okay,
I have a Wii.
Yeah, because you
the
have
quality
to watch it through
shit.
She is
Wii.
Really? But my Xbox, I was watching through my Xbox, and I'm like, this is fantastic. And then my Xbox Live subscription ran out that they gave you for free, and you have to pay for Xbox Live to watch.
So
Netflix.
It doesn't have anything to do with my internet connection. It's the
system. Because the system.
It's like watching like second generation VHS.
Well, and you're probably used to HDMI, right?
Yeah.
At this point.
So it's not even like an Xbox?
It's way better on Xbox than on
PlayStation.
Below
Like it's standard like, definition is fine. This is below that.
I'd buy a PlayStation for that. I mean, you get a Blu-ray player. And
yeah.
All that. Anyway.
Yokozuna Undertaker. So we start off with a face-to-face stare down between the two. And, we got into the chair shots here.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, Yokozuna is sent into the casket. But then Crush runs down and attacks the Undertaker. And he fights off Crush. They fight to the floor. Then the Great Kabuki is the next one out, along with Tenryu, who were the henchmen hired by Mr. Fuji.
So did they bring these guys in just for... Were they in...
They had...
Weren't they working with Cornette?
Tenryu was doing his war promotion over in Japan, and I think they had some loose agreement at that time. Kabuki, I don't know who he was working with at that time. Kabuki might have just been independent at that point. I don't even know if he was associated with any company at that juncture. But anyway, they were the Japanese muscle hired by Fuji to take care of the Undertaker, and Both were taken out with a double clothesline by The Undertaker. Then Bigelow runs out. Crush returns. Yoko is laying in the casket. Fuji then steals the urn from Paul Bearer until Paul Bearer comes over and lays out Fuji and Cornette and takes the urn back to give The Undertaker his power to fight them off. Adam Bomb and Jeff Jarrett are out. Jeff Jarrett complete with a Billy and Chuck headband. They join the heels. The Head Shrinkers come out. A team called the Head Shrinkers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Samoan Head Shrinkers.
Yeah. Like, that's any worse than, you know, anything. There's nothing
wrong. No, that's...
That's... How many wrestling fans grew up thinking that Samoans can't feel pain in their head?
Well, like, how many wrestling fans grew up thinking that Yokozuna was Japanese?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like, how many... I did. I was like, oh, he must be Eurasian.
He looks Japanese,
something. Like,
yeah.
You know?
This part was great. We had, like, eight heels laying out The Undertaker, and then the last guy to run out is Diesel.
Yeah.
He just gets into the ring, everything's done, and he's just, like, standing around
it
there.
It seemed like he missed his cue or something.
But was, like, is he meant to be a heel? Because he kind of came... Wasn't he hitting The Undertaker, too?
He was a heel at this time, yeah.
He was still, like, Shawn Michaels' bodyguard at this
point.
But
then Shawn Michaels later on is terrified of him, and...
Because they're in the Rumble, and it's every man for themselves.
Oh, but I thought it was because they had already broken off from each other.
No, they were still aligned together, and this was kind of building up the break.
Okay. Because I was like, are they just... Is the roster just that thin that they're now like, you're a babyface normally, but just get up there and play the heel and attack The Undertaker, because we need a lot of people to attack him.
I really felt Diesel was... Like, they were getting him the monster push in the Rumble, mm-hmm. that in this beatdown, he was just like heel number 7 out of 8.
Yeah.
He just felt like another guy there.
Well, maybe because they were trying to turn him, or they were hoping to turn him, they didn't want to send him out and have him beat up The Undertaker.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, it continued then, and Undertaker made a comeback. Undertaker just booked like Superman here.
Yeah. John Cena booking.
Complete with supernatural power. Fights off the heels. Yokozuna then punches Paul Bearer off the apron and takes the urn as Diesel joins the heels to beat down Taker. Yokozuna hits him with the urn, and then green smoke starts coming out of the urn, and Vince yells, "The power of the urn is escaping!" I would love to say this is 1994 ridiculous WWF booking, but I'm watching Kane and John Cena today do the same crazy shit. Fatu then hits a splash off the top. Taker gets laid out. They put him in the casket. The match ends 14 minutes and 24 seconds, 8 of which was this beatdown here. I don't know how hurt Taker was here, but he was getting a significant amount of time off after this show, to the point he would miss WrestleMania. He'd be gone until that SummerSlam, the infamous Undertaker versus Undertaker match.
Oh.
So, post-match, what a post-match this was,
oh,
to contrast to the Owen Brett stuff. Smoke is coming from the casket. The lights go out in the arena, and then The Undertaker lasers through the casket and up to the big screen, where we zoom in on The Undertaker, and he awakens. And the
and
voice,
he's in the casket.
He's in the casket.
Yeah.
We have a camera in the casket, and he says, "The spirit of The Undertaker lives within the soul of all mankind, the eternal flame of life that cannot be extinguished, the origin of which cannot be explained. The answer lies in the everlasting spirit. Soon all mankind will witness the rebirth of The Undertaker, and I will not rest in peace." And I got this verbatim from The Undertaker's mouth. And then The Undertaker exploded into a CGI effect. And then he rose from the screen and was lifted to the rafters. But this was so poorly lit that you could barely see Marty Jannetty in an Undertaker outfit lifted into the rafters.
So was that Marty
It was Marty Jannetty.
Okay, I was wondering if that's...
Because they had Taker legit in the cast.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I was wondering if that was the first appearance of the other Undertaker.
I guess that was... I don't know.
They dressed Jannetty up as Taker. I didn't know that.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that explains why it was poorly lit.
And then Paul Bearer gets the urn and puts it on the casket. This was crazy.
I sent some, distaste from your tone.
You enjoyed this?
I fucking loved this.
Oh, I thought it was ridiculous. This is like Mordecai. Like.
Dude, I love this entire segment. Everything from the beatdown, because they made Taker look like a monster.
A monster,
they,
yeah.
They Taker
yeah,
look, like, true. Look like, you know, some netherworld creature that couldn't be taken down. And it was just like a really cool, especially for me, like seeing all these guys run out one after the another, just try to, you know, guys that I haven't seen in years come down and try to beat down The Undertaker. I thought it was great. And, you know, even the science experiment inside the urn, I thought was cool. Listen, when you're watching The Undertaker from the 90s, you're not watching anything serious. Everything from the promos leading up to this, where he's making the casket, everything about it is camp. Everything about it screams camp to me. And, like, if you're watching this like a bad horror movie, it's fucking awesome. It's hilarious. And, you know, all of a sudden, he's inside a casket, and he's cutting this really these really cheesy lines that are only, you know, only he could deliver, and then it explodes, and now all of a sudden I'm watching Phantom of the Opera. They really weren't afraid to go overboard with their special effects here, and I just loved it. I had a lot of fun watching.
The most
all
enjoyable
this.
Part is picturing someone next to you on the bus looking over and seeing what you're watching.
Yeah,
I guarantee you that was probably not the weirdest thing being watched on that bus.
I would have loved to have been in the production meeting of Vince coming up with this plan. Oh, how are we going to write off the Undertaker? We could just beat him, the injury angle.
No. Gonna blow him up.
I see green smoke. I see a laser and it fucking explodes, goddammit. With the Japanese guy.
See, that's the thing with the Undertaker character, though. I mean, contrast this, like you said, with the Bret and Owen stuff, where that stuff is very grounded in reality. Then you have this character that allows the writers to just go nuts, go sci-fi, go horror, do whatever they want.
The other thing that I forgot to mention at the very beginning of that promo is how weird Paul Bearer looked when he was riding that horse cart. The horse-drawn cart, the horse-drawn hearse, I mean, that he was riding. He looked so weird with his big stomach and his little tiny legs sitting up there. Oh, that was terrifying. That was the scariest part of the match for me.
So that was the end of The Undertaker for 8 months.
Goodbye, Undertaker.
He exploded. Then we go into the Rumble match, and we get comments from Randy Savage, Jeff Jarrett, Tatanka, Diesel, Doink and Dink, Shawn Michaels and Lex Luger. Everyone's going to win the Royal Rumble. And the match starts off with Scott Steiner and Samu. And I didn't know... actually, that spot came later. But they start off, it's every 90 seconds, and the countdown clock has a sponsor in Casio.
The Casio.
Sponsored the...
I was wondering if they just made the clock. This is like...
What's the clock from the scoreboard, probably?
That's true, actually. Yeah.
It was during when Rick Steiner came in third. They're double-teaming Samu. And they throw him into the ropes, and Samu goes over the top, and he ties his head into the ropes.
Yeah, and he's,
I rewound this like five times.
He's hanging
amazed
there
at this spot.
Oh, this was the Foley spot. This was a hangman spot.
This was more impressive than when Foley did it. This guy got like significant height going over the top and got his head in between the ropes and tied them up without any use of his arms. How this did not get fucked up, I am amazed. But this was the spot of the show for me.
It was amazing. Cool.
Yeah, I actually thought at first that it might have been a screw up, but then it looks like
the thing is it
looks too good.
But it was done to no effect. Like he was eliminated right afterwards, so maybe it was. Maybe, you know.
This was Samu stealing the Rumble for me. This was awesome. Quang.
Also, the Rumble is the worst main event. Like, I know you can't really put anything on after it, but like, there's no story to the Rumble. Like,
what do you mean?
There can be stories to the Rumble, I guess.
Tons
like
of story.
You could have the narrative of the person going through, but like. Mm-hmm. I find that the Rumble is all battle royales. I find so hard to focus because it's just like maybe that's my.
But I love the Rumble because you have. I mean, I have to disagree because in the Rumble you can have many different storylines.
Yeah, that's true.
You can build many different storylines.
That's true.
Just for the fan with ADD, it's like. Yeah, but you just had the who's coming out next drama.
And anytime you get down to the final four, like those are the four people you focus on. Those are the four people you remember, and you know. What better way to build to a WrestleMania main event than to have a guy go through 30?
Yeah, that's true.
You might be the only person I know that doesn't enjoy the Rumble.
I know. I enjoy the Rumble. I just don't enjoy the Rumble itself. That event. I always enjoy the pay-per-view, but it's... Anyway, I what do I mean? No, I'm like that guy on the phone. No, I totally agree with you. Yeah, the Rumble's amazing. I love the Rumble. Hey, yeah, totally.
All opinions welcome here.
All opinions welcome.
Not everybody likes it.
No, apparently not.
Quang is out, played by Savio Vega. Then Owen Hart, who just came out to tons of boos.
Yeah.
Angle clearly got over live to the crowd here. And Rick Steiner, I believe, was the first. Actually, Samu was eliminated, and then Rick Steiner. We won't go through all the eliminations here. It'll just take too long. Bart Gunn was in next. And then Vince says that something's going on in the back, but we never cut to the back. We were just led to believe something.
Well, they do cut to it later.
Yes.
But like, there must have been a screw-up, because he's taking forever. He's like, we're getting a camera crew there. And I guess they actually, unlike in most wrestling events where they're like, we're sending a camera crew there, and then immediately because this camera crew had to get there, set up, do a light test, you know.
White balance.
White balance. Like, does anyone have a sheet of white paper? We got to do a white balance before we do the shot.
DiBiase was putting over how he drew number one during one of the Rumbles, and he lasted over 50 minutes and discussing just how difficult it can be. Diesel was the seventh entrant and just went crazy. He eliminated Scott Steiner, Bart Gunn, Owen Hart, gone, and Quang before the next entrant, who turned out to be Bob Backlund, the man he would win his title from later that year. And Backlund teases trying to get Diesel out, but then Diesel just drops him out right away, and he awaits the next entrant, who was Billy Gunn. And they did this gimmick where you could call the WWF hotline to find out who the next entrant was.
Cash grab.
Was any amount of money worth not waiting 90 seconds?
I need to know.
Who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? Virgil was the answer.
I guarantee a lot of kids got yelled at that next month when that phone bill
came
in.
Fuck is on this bill? Like,
you called 30 times to find out?
They go eventually backstage and they show Tenryu and Kabuki attacking Lex Luger in what looked like my high school hallway, complete with lockers and stickers on the lockers. Not exactly your three-point lighting setup with backdrop you get today in the WWF.
Oh.
Virgil's out next, and they announce Virgil is the alternate for Kamala. Virgil was not amongst the top 30 people we have in this company.
Was he even on the roster at this point? Because they say they're like, haven't seen him for a long time.
Yeah, he got the call.
He must have been just backstage visiting. They're like, get out there, get out there.
Calling from the autograph table.
Virgil, we'd ask if you're busy, but we know the answer.
He like shows up with his wrestling superstar banner. He's like, I was just here to work the parking lot.
Yeah. As long as I don't have to do an interview. Virgil, he hits a bunch of forearms and then he gets dumped out. And then number 11 was Randy Savage, which Damian mentioned. Giant pop when he came
Huge
out
pop.
Here.
By the way, everybody, all these eliminations beforehand, courtesy of Kevin Nash, who was being groomed for that babyface turn. And, you know, the Rumble's always been a place for the big man to shine, and this was used very effectively for Kevin Nash.
But the crowd was behind Kevin Nash.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I thought maybe he'd already turned.
It was hard not to.
He
was booked like this superhuman monster in this match, and it was Savage who ended the series of eliminations. Mm-hmm. Jeff Jarrett was then in next, who attacks Savage and does his strut as Diesel's recovering. And this is when they kind of built things up. Crush then came out, him and Savage had this feud going on at the time. Doink was out next, and they show the split screen here where this was amazing. They eliminated Randy Savage as Doink was doing his entrance, and they had to show Savage in the split screen getting eliminated. Mm-hmm. You would think one of the bigger eliminations in this very talent-thin roster of Rumble participants. Mm-hmm.
Doink, though, was over huge.
Yes.
Crowd loved Doink.
Yeah.
Bam Bam Bigelow was out next, and then Diesel and Crush, they welcome Bigelow in to finish Doink, and then gets press slammed to the floor, but then Diesel and Crush go to eliminate Bigelow, then Crush punches Diesel, and all three heels start attacking, and we needed a big baby face, and that cued Mabel, came out with Oscar. Some talent we had in there between Mabel, Kevin Nash, and Crush, all in the ring together.
Some of the greatest big men in the business.
Yeah. Chance of whoop. There it is.
Yeah.
Oh, Mabel. Number 17 was the debut of Sparky Plug.
You're kidding. This was his debut?
Yeah, Vince said it, making his debut.
And he was an alternate too, right?
Yeah, he was replacing the 1-2-3 kid who was injured.
And Vince here, man.
Loved this race car driver.
Trying to sell the possibility of Thurman Sparky Plug going on to main event WrestleMania.
And this guy would stay with the company for like 12 years.
Yeah. Yeah, he would.
Shawn Michaels was out 18th and shakes the hand of Diesel and then sits on the top rope. And then everyone tries to eliminate Diesel. And then Shawn comes in from behind and he shoves Diesel over. And this would be the beginning of the seeds of their breakup, which would not occur until SummerSlam.
Mm-hmm. They started the tease here in January for a turn in August.
Awesome. And it would go through WrestleMania.
Yes, they would then meet at WrestleMania the following year. Fans were cheering Diesel here, even chanting his name.
Yeah.
Then Mo came out, Greg Valentine, Tatanka, and the Great Kabuki. And everyone's trying to eliminate Mabel, with the exception of Mo, and then they eventually get Mabel out. They play up Shawn Michaels barely surviving but holding on. Lex Luger came out next and was attacked by Kabuki right away.
See, Luger comes out. He's not selling any type of injury at all. He just runs out like nothing happened. I felt that whole backstage scene was quite unnecessary, especially considering, you know, you're doing the same gimmick with Brett throughout the entire show, and it's a much better effect with Brett.
So yeah.
There's no need with Luger.
And in fact, it kind of diminishes Brett's entrance because you've already had a guy who's been, like, injured and counted out.
But
know?
It didn't really affect his pop at all. Because, like, you know, you could tell the crowd only cared about Brett.
Brett, no, absolutely.
Brett, Luger's injury was whatever.
Tenru was out 24th, followed by, number 25, Nobody came out. And you were left to
believe. That's what was supposed to be Brett, right?
This was supposed to be Brett's spot, but he's injured. Rick Martel came out, number 26. And then number 27 was Bret Hart. Got a massive pop coming out.
Selling the entire time.
Yep.
Limping to the ring.
Yeah.
And then it finished off with Fatu, Marty Jannetty, who, when he came in and attacked Shawn Michaels, the crowd went nuts.
Yeah.
Really, we're into that. And they cut to the back, and we go to Ray Rougeau, who is interviewing Crush. This was awesome. And Crush tells him to get out of his face. And in the back of the shot, we see Adam Bomb giving away any drama as to who would be number 30. And we see Randy Savage in street clothes attack Crush in the back. Rougeau was just so unconvincing at being alarmed here. He's like, oh, we need help. We need help. He just, just nailing it in here. And then it cut to this fake static noise because the camera had just been overrun by the chaos of Crush and Randy Savage. And surprise, surprise, Adam Bomb was out number 30th. And they announced Bastion Booger was sick and was not able to compete in the number 25 slot. And our roster is so thin, we couldn't get an alternate. We were fleshed out of alternates. We already got Virgil.
And Sparky Plug.
And Sparky Plug. and then Plug was eliminated. Martel eliminated Valentine. We go through a bunch of eliminations here. Final four was down to, who did we have here? Bret Hart, Lex Luger, Shawn Michaels, and Fatu.
And Fatu.
Who did not belong? There was a double Irish rip, but Michaels and Fatu avoided each other, and then Luger and Bret eliminate Michaels and Fatu at the same time, and comes down to Hart and Luger, and you get the big spot where Luger went to body slam Hart. Both men went over at the exact same time. It was timed very well. And then afterwards, Finkel announces Luger is the winner. Then Earl Hebner is pleading Brett's case, and which that turned out to be funny. Earl Hebner is stepping up for Brett here. And the referees are arguing. They then announce Brett as the winner. And the big story, at least as it's told, is that it was the reaction Brett got here during this post-match that they ended up changing plans, because the original idea was Luger winning the title at Mania, but the reaction was so stronger here for Brett that Vince chose there that night that it would be Brett that would get the title.
Hmm.
So in a weird way, that Providence crowd kind of booked Mania here. And Jack Tunney comes down to the ring. They show the replays. And Finkel finally announces, after lots of stalling, a tie. And unlike TNA, they did not have an overtime match on Raw the following
night. This is the first tie, right, that they ever had? For the-
I believe
yes.
so.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So that was the Royal Rumble.
You know, not, go ahead, Damien.
I was gonna say, like it's funny how there can never be like a perfect time where WWE is firing on all cylinders. Like it's either the undercard, but I guess it's the there's no real undercard and no real main event card in this because the main event guys working on the undercard like Brett and things like that. But also like there really was no guy that could carry the company at this point. Like Brett the Hitman Hart. Unbelievable wrestler, and in Canada can carry a company, but I don't think you could ever have a Canadian carry that company in the U.S. Like, or someone that is at least a pronounced Canadian.
Yeah, Brett was always like a pretty good draw internationally, but yeah, the stick business was really down for the company at this point. And I mean, they were trying with Luger to replace him, but that I just never felt it clicked.
Yeah.
To a top guy, just connecting with the audience at that point, but
the biggest positive I took out of this show was that after this show, even if you didn't know the card for WrestleMania, in your head, you could piece it all together. Like, all the top matches were laid out here. Mm-hmm. You had Razor and Shawn. You had Bret and Owen. You had the controversy at top on top of the title. Savage and Crush. I mean, you knew kind of the top end of WrestleMania after this show.
I think WWE's trying to do that this year. Like, I think by Royal Rumble, we're going to know the top. Like, you know, you have the Undertaker Triple H match, which is going to be a nightmare. But then you have the Rock and John Cena, and then you're going to have CM Punk and Jericho, if people are being led to believe. And that should be all kind of hammered out by...
I think it should be that way every year, you know?
Yeah.
The matches need time in order for them to be important. And, you know, I love this show. I really enjoyed this event. I personally loved the cast of characters that were involved, and I thought they were all... They were all connecting with the crowd. They were all involved in really good storylines. I really enjoyed the Undertaker stuff with the Yoko. I loved the Bret and Owen stuff. Even, like, you know, Diesel's build in the Rumble itself I thought was tremendous. So, you know, I only detract points from this because this was not a classic Rumble match. There really weren't any classic matches on this show, but nonetheless, for me, it was a very fun show to watch. So I give this an 8.5 out of 10.
8.5.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you love this period of wrestling.
I really did, yeah.
I gave this show a 5. It didn't blow me away, but the booking, I thought there was some really good booking on this show in terms of setting up WrestleMania. Not a great Rumble match by any stretch. But I really loved the stuff with Owen. I thought that stuff was just really great, and at least gave you a really good setup for WrestleMania.
Yeah, I'd say 5-2 for me, because once again, Owen, fantastic. Tatanka, who I kind of
really love Tatanka.
I look back at him being so bad. You know, when I remember Tatanka in my memory, I'm just like, oh, I never really liked Tatanka. But like watching this, it's like, wow, he was really good. And Bam Bam Bigelow, you know, I think is one of the most consistently kind of underrated people, because he
got a half decent match out of Lawrence Taylor once.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was a guy who, like, some of those, you know, talk about Taz again, but some of those matches with Taz were like some of the best matches in the history of ECW, in my opinion. So my dad called me at 108, and I have 107 on my phone. And my dad called me in the future.
I was just about to call you.
Yeah, I know. Hey, Dad. Hey, how you? Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. Yeah, like if he's okay with doing that. Sure. No, or if worse comes to worse, I'll meet up with him. Okay. Well, thank you so much for doing that, Dad. Give my love to Wanda. Love you too. Talk to you later. Bye. So I'm just gonna call my wife again.
Put that "love you too" in there.
That was my dad. Put that in there. Was this recording too? I'm going to look like such an asshole. I'm glad at least people will know that I'm calling my family and not like pretending like I'm on the phone with like a celebrity.
You genuinely love your family.
All my little cousins used to like wrestling when they were younger, and I was older, and I was never like, even though I did see really like wrestling, I was always like, I don't really watch it. But so now they're all like, you really? You? Because I talk to them about it all the time. Now they're like, how do you like wrestling still? I'm like, it's a progress.
Every time I go to like, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas with my extended family. It's like, this year actually I went and my cousins were like, we heard your Rogers call. I was like, oh, that's funny.
My family members, like, they know wrestling, but they don't know MMA. So, like, they think all MMA is wrestling. They think it's all, like, just...
They think it's all staged?
Yeah. Oh, really? They think it's all real.
Real? Yeah, because when you talked about your parents in the past, they've always seemed like they...
Yeah, they think it's all real, but they all think it's pro wrestling. Like, they all think it's under the name pro wrestling, but they think it's all real.
My parents think... My dad kind of, I think, knows a little bit, but my mom, I remember when I was a kid, was like, it's all fake. Like, the blood's fake. Like, everything's fake. It doesn't hurt and stuff like that.
You have two types of people, I guess. You have the people that think it's all real, or the people that are just completely don't buy any of it.
I know, and little do they realize that the truth is somewhere in the middle, and that's where it's really fun to be.
Yeah.
It's really exciting to like be like, what's real, what's fake?
Yeah. And then you have Nate Diaz after the Cerrone fight. Yo, man, I was just... All that stuff was bullshit. I was just trying to promote the fight.
Yeah.
And it's like, MMA fans don't get on that at all.
Well, that's what I thought.
Like, guys, what do you think these guys are doing here?
When,
just making shit up with each other to hype a fight.
When Shamrock fought Tito Ortiz, like, 3 or 4 years ago now, and it was like the grudge match to end all grudge matches going in, like the promos they were cutting, like, I'm going to murder him, like, I'm going to get, and then they started, the first one got stopped early, so then they did like the rematch,
yeah.
And at the end, after they've said all these horrible things, they hug. And I'm like, this cannot be anything but professional wrestling. Like, at least in professional wrestling,
they knew exactly what they were doing.
They, at least in professional wrestling, they wait till they get backstage before they hug.
Yeah.
You know, like, they wait till at least the cameras have stopped rolling for them to admit that you just got worked. You know, like, they tell you that as soon as the pay-per-view's over. It's like, yeah, you just got work. These two guys don't actually hate each other.
Do any of us as fans, you know, having watched that and...
No, exactly.
You know, do we care?
No,
we don't.
Well, except I kind of wish sometimes, like... Sometimes the heel guy is an asshole in the UFC, and I wish the babyface guy was like, no, he's a dick. Like, I kind of, like, you know, that's what... George St. Pierre never, you know, him and Josh Koscheck never really, like... bonded afterwards, I don't think, because I think Josh Koscheck kind of like...
He is a dick.
He was kind of a dick, you know, and I think George St. Pierre realized that he kind of legitimately was a dick, you know, like...
Yeah.
All right, let's...
let's go to feedback.
I am sorry, guys. I don't get a lot of time to get this out of my system, so when
I love doing these shows.
Say whatever you want.
All right, you want to start us off, Way?
Yeah. Let's go to Hanzi.
Who was unsuccessful on Title Bout Trivia this past Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was the same guy. Oh, wow.
Hanzi.
Regular on the Howard Stern show.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Hanzi.
Super fan. You know what's crazy? I was listening to Aftermath one time, and John of Arc called.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
He makes the rounds.
It threw me off, right? Because I have my listening, you know, like areas, and then when the streams get crossed, I don't know what to do.
We once had a caller who... I won't out him, but he called in and then called into Aftermath the next night, and it was like the identical
question
comment.
Oh,
like to the point I took the two and put them together.
Have you guys seen Big Fan yet? I told you guys about that last time, but the Patton Oswalt movie.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, you got to see it. You got to see it. Both of you guys coming from sports radio or sports entertainment radio, but would just love, like. It's all about a guy who just is obsessed with calling in to comment about the Mets on this
totally
radio show. And he's like,
what's it called?
A big fan.
I think it
might be on Netflix. And he writes out his call before he calls in.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's fantastic. That's awesome. A really dark but funny kind of movie.
Well.
Anyway.
Now we read what you actually write and have us read. Hanzi, I remember this event had me on the edge of my seat. As a kid, this was the main event I wanted to see... Because they built this feud up well, and you wanted to see Yokozuna's reign come to an end because he was defeating all the faces. I remember losing my mind when Taker was still alive when 15 or so guys had to put him in the casket. Other great moments were when Owen officially turned heel. I remember Diesel had a really good showing during the Rumble. And Bret Hart and Lex Luger winning had me intrigued because I wanted to know who was going to face Yoko at Mania. This was probably my favorite event as a kid. Anyway, sorry for the length of my post. I know how much you guys hate that.
Not at all. Jason Chapa, I watched this in Scramble Vision, and it was one of the first pay-per-views I saw live. I could make a big deal about the entire show being viewed through rose-colored glasses, but instead I'll just leave you with this anecdote. I was firmly drinking the kayfabe Kool-Aid at the time, and when Undertaker died on national television, I cried. The evil Yokozuna Inc. killed my favorite wrestler, and he went to heaven. How else was a 9-year-old fan supposed to react? I wonder if WWE evokes this type of reaction from its PG crowd nowadays.
If they had John Cena
all the time when I watch some wrestling today.
If you had John Cena rise into the ceiling, I think you could.
I think it would be awesome to do a Death of Superman angle with John Cena.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, and they could have four John Cenas
come back, and you're like wondering which one's the real one.
Yeah. Wasn't that a giant comic book when it sold? Superman's logo.
I think it's still the biggest selling comic book of all time.
I was not in the comics, but I remember that came out. That's what every kid I knew was talking about.
I paid like $30 for that comic book.
Wow.
Because I bought it like 3 days later.
$30. Wow.
He's got a song out of it.
That was Crash's Dummies.
Oh, Superman's dead.
Oh, is that his? I'm not an Our Lady Peace fan. I was thinking about the Superman never made any money.
Yeah. They had a Superman.
But that was that
Superman's
predates the death
dead
of
was
Superman.
Our Lady Peace, and then Crash's Dummies had another one.
Where the video is a funeral for Superman. and for the Crash Test Dummies. Because I think I'm a couple years older than you guys, or a few years older than you guys. I think our reference Canadian points are just out of sync. Just out of sync. You know, we're going to have to go to Steal My Sunshine to get both of us back on
board.
Yes,
that's right.
I definitely think that this one of those time periods that, you know, you can watch now as a wrestling fan being like, you would have to be a little kid to buy it. You know, you have to be a little kid to buy the death of, you know, The Undertaker.
I think Way shed a bit of a tear on his cruise.
It's still real to me, damn it.
Oh, yeah, I was crying on that bus. Yeah, you should
cry on the bus.
Well, I mean, do you guys think that, you know, back at this time in 94, there were many adults watching? What was the audience like back then?
Yeah.
I have no idea. It'd be fun to an event like that during this time period. You always think of how time periods would be viewed like today, and that would be, I don't know.
I don't think wrestling ever has to be geared towards adults to be good. I mean, I think...
No, because this stuff still happens today. Like, look at Paul Bearer. Look how he wound up. Yeah. You know, he got murdered.
Just has to be good storytelling.
Murdered twice, I guess, on TV, right?
Exactly, yeah. Okay, let's go to Thulani. A lot of people who never saw this event when it first aired in 94 will find little impressive with the show now, mainly because the WWE has made a habit of taking historical and memorable moments and rehashing them countless times on TV, thereby watering down the significance of the initial events. Case in point, Undertaker's death and resurrection. When that shit first happened in the 94 Rumble, it gave me nightmares as a kid, and even today I mark out whenever I see that segment. But for a lot of today's fans who have seen this angle happen almost every year since 03, the original angle doesn't have as much impact. The same can be said about the double elimination finish in the Rumble match itself. I think the WWE ran that exact same finish a few times with Benoit on TV. If they'd left that angle untouched, it would have been something the fans would still be talking about today. That said, I still look fondly on the new generation era of the WWF. I give the show an 8 out of 10.
Atish Singh, I remember back in these days always being able to predict the Rumble winner. I remember not being able to decide between Brett and Luger since both had a ton of momentum going into it. I wasn't too surprised about a week later watching Superstars on Saturday and finding out that both men were declared the winner. There was no internet back then, so I had to wait till the next weekend to find out pay-per-view results. I loved Owen's heel turn. It was expected but done well. Brett's job at selling after Owen kicked his leg from under his leg was vintage Brett. Nobody in wrestling history was a better storyteller and master of ring psychology than the Hitman. This led to the greatest opening WrestleMania match ever and one of the best steel cage matches ever at SummerSlam. And thanks us for our podcast. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Atish.
You're welcome.
Devin, the death of The Undertaker was probably the first time I ever rolled my eyes and said, "This is stupid," while watching a wrestling show. The first of many, many times over the next 17 years. Yes, pro wrestling is a kind of a live-action cartoon when you come down to it, but that doesn't mean it has to be a stupid cartoon.
I think it got way dumber, though, a couple months later at WrestleMania when Leslie Nielsen was brought in the lead-up to investigate... Oh, no, maybe it was the Summer Story. It was that Summer Story.
Right, going into the Summer
Story. To investigate who the real Undertaker is, and he's playing... Not did they bring Leslie Nielsen, the guy from Airport, to play a real detective. They bring him in as the guy from Naked Gun.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Like some jokey detective. And that, to me, was like my shake my head moment for wrestling.
Okay. Rob Williams. I remember as a 10-year-old being scared shitless of the Undertaker angle. I remember having to go to the bathroom after and not wanting to go. Looking back, I'm still amazed at how well they played off the dual winner finish. Even though it was done again, albeit accidentally, this was still great and unique for the time. Yeah, that was he's referring to the Cena and Batista that year where they went over the top, where I don't think that went as planned. It seemed like...
Because we had Corderis come in and talking to us about that, and all that stuff was called on the fly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that the one where Vince came out and blew both his quads?
Yeah.
Both his quads? Yeah, I remember when you guys...
Sitting and yelling.
A
great Rumble.
But also, like, once again, a situation that... Could you imagine, like... There's a major problem with the iPhone 4 when it comes out, and Steve Jobs, rest in peace, come running out to stop the assembly line and like tripping and tearing his quads and sitting there yelling at the people on the assembly line.
I guarantee you, he wouldn't have been to continue his rant.
Like, well,
he would have medics on.
Yeah, exactly. But also, he wouldn't do that. You know, like it takes a certain kind of CEO, and only of a wrestling company would you have this type of CEO. To, like, look at something go wrong, and instead of, you know, radioing to someone on their earpiece or something, comes storming out himself and tears us both his quad muscles.
Vince McMahon is just one of the greatest characters this world has ever produced.
I feel
the WWE will be a lot more boring.
I would love if someone did a really well-researched biography on him, like when he's passed away probably would be easiest, but because there's so much stuff that how this guy takes or what was like a carny business and take it to the level where it is a legitimate form of entertainment.
I'm just curious about all the things that we don't know about him.
When
in his house, what he's like, I don't know, just like what he's like outside of work, if he has a life outside
well
of
that's it. That story that's Logano's podcast I thought was fantastic for giving you like this sort of image of this guy who's like in his ivory tower eating steak or the steak and ketchup wraps all day. And just like, who's like trying to do like 15 different jobs that like in any other corporation would be delegated.
And he never wants that version of himself to ever be seen. It's like you have this amazingly complex character, but he'll never allow that side of him to be seen.
I guess you kind of see it a little bit in Wrestling with Shadows.
Towards the end, look how he fought tooth and nail. He was fine with that entire thing other than him leaving the locker room after he had been punched and looking weak.
Yeah.
And you just get little bits and pieces of him. But I think a lot of the writers now, they have to sign certain stuff where they can't talk about stuff after they leave.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Because, you'd be, why isn't there more shoot stuff, you know? And, why were all the guys on Dave Lugano's podcast so cagey with the details? Like, you think they would be like, well, this one time, this very specific incident happened where this and this and this and this went down.
Yeah, they wouldn't make sense. Yeah, I mean, you know, you would expect it. Kevin Waters. I'm a huge Brett fan, so my 10-year-old self was hoping the Hitman would win it all. Like others, I had to wait a whole week to find out the winner. 3 months till the Coliseum home video. And needless to say, I was pissed. A tie? Can that happen? But I guess it all worked out at WrestleMania 10. I remember the coin toss to determine who faced Yoko first and how Brett essentially had two major feuds that year, with Yoko and Lex over the belt and with Owen, and how they bled into each other. Watching these old rumbles makes me glad that they use music now for the entrance. If they had back then, I would feel like the match... I feel it would make the match better. When Nash was dominating everyone, and all of a sudden you hear Pomp and Circumstance, that place would have gone crazy for Randy. Thanks for the entertainment.
We go to Blaine. This was certainly not my favorite Royal Rumble of all time, but there were definitely some memorable moments. Owen Hart was great on the show, and I thought his backstage promo with Todd Pettengill was actually better with the screw-up. I didn't care for when they would keep switching announcers in between matches, though. Luckily, it only lasted a couple of pay-per-views. I thought the matches before the Rumble were pretty good, and the Rumble itself was decent, and they did a good job of keeping fans guessing by having both Bret Hart and Lex Luger seemingly canceled out before the match started. After watching this again, I thought the casket match ending was a little over the top, but when I watched this for the first time as a 10-year-old, I thought it was great. The Rumble match ending in a draw was innovative at the time, but looking back, I would have preferred it went to sudden victory.
Mark Cardoso, I remember seeing the 94 Rumble on pay-per-view. I hated the ending to the casket match where Yokozuna needed 500 guys to beat The Undertaker in the match, and then having Marty Jannetty dressed as Taker levitated to the building. Just felt stupid. The Owen heel turn was great and made for great drama in the Rumble when no one came out for their entrant and everyone thought it was Brett. Mike Shaw lost his spot for an angle, and Vince telling people the alternates for people advertised for the Rumble was a first, I believe, as well. I don't know if they still have alternates these days in the Royal Rumble.
And they do the surprises.
Because the Diesel one last year. Sorry, I keep moving away from this microphone. It's like I forgot how to do radio. The Diesel one last year and the Booker T one last year.
Right.
I guess that was also what Greg the Hammer Valentine probably was.
Yeah, because he wasn't working.
Yeah, they said he'd been off TV. They were like, oh, we haven't seen him in years. Yeah. And you know, so yeah, he must have been their nostalgia pop. Hmm.
David Warden writes, the amazing thing about this event is how much the featured roster had changed from 1992. Did Vince really need to lose all those guys at once? It was called drug testing. Plus, how crazy is it to consider this event with the 99 Rumble? It's completely different in every way. And then look at the same time span from 2007 to this year, in which time basically nothing has changed. Okay, the Monday Night War was a contributing factor, but the bottom line is the Vince of the 90s was motivated to mix things up when they weren't working, and today he's not. There were five or six guys worthy of mega pushes at this time, like the Harts, Michaels, Hall, and Savage, but Vince wanted his freak show, and this event suffered for that, like many others. He gives us a 6 out of 10.
I agree with that sentiment about time.
The evolution of the product.
Well, but not just in pro wrestling, but I feel like with life in general. I don't know, man. For me, like,
now.
The past... Well, I mean, like, just for the past 5 years, I look at so many things from 07 that are... And they still seem current to me. They still seem fresh to me.
I think it's because culturally things are shifting at a much quicker pace, whereas, like, you had, you know, from 85 to 90... You had a long kind of like a drawn out period where, you know, music changed and film changed. You had like the rise of like Reservoir Dogs and the rise of Nirvana and things like that all happening. Whereas now things are changing, but it's happened so quick that all the changes just blend into each other. Like we don't really have, I guess the defining social group of our generation would be the hipster. But, you know, like that is just because there's no other, you know, because like the people that are into swag music are here for 6 months and then gone. And the people that were into blog house were here for 6 months and gone. And I'm sure dubstep will be the same way. You know, there's just like, you know, there are people that will still retain that kind of stuff. But for the most part, you know, we just live in a point. But I was thinking the exact same thing the other day because I was watching 2003 Judgment Day with my friend the other day. Or maybe it was 2008. And it was like, oh, Triple H is winning. Hey, it's like it's like this for all of 2000. Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, when you go back and watch, you know, an event like, say we picked a Raw from 93, it's a giant change.
But giant change, yeah.
When we review a Raw from 2001, I mean, it's right down to the formula. Yeah. A guy comes out, cuts a promo to start the match. We've got our 8 segments. We've got our top of the hour main event. We've got the overrun segment. It's they have got a formula down pat.
The formula is the same. The look is the same.
Everything.
The cast is the same.
Right down to Titantron. Like, nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And you could watch a 2007 Raw, and I think a bunch of people would have no clue what year it was.
Mm. The only way I gauge... you know, time is through Apple products. Because, I mean, when you really think about it, in 07, we didn't. Did we even have the iPhone in 07?
2007?
I think that's the birth of the iPhone.
The iPod was like 2004.
Yeah.
I don't think the iPhone was... I don't know. I could
be
wrong.
We didn't have the iPhone. We didn't have the iPad.
I don't know. Sorry, can we take a break for the bathroom?
Yep.
Looks like I'm doing Coke, but
right
I... These energy drinks, I don't know how you guys are retaining it.
It's a... Our bodies are messed. No, I was. I did.
That's good.
Yeah. It was nice to be completely detached from everything, too.
Sorry.
And, like, I had no choice because, like, Wi-Fi on the boat, you might have run into this as well, but, like, the internet connection on the boat is, like,
terrible.
Expensive.
Yeah.
No, expensive.
Oh, really?
Like, really, really pricey. So, like, I had no excuse but to do that. And they also paid for soft drink. You also had to pay for soft drinks and alcohol too. So I drank nothing but water all week, and it was cool. Like, it was cool. It forces you to
party, you know,
off of things.
What are you drinking?
I had one
water.
Beer.
I had one beer.
Nice. The pictures I've seen from this cruise that we're doing from last year look like the most debauched Jersey Shore-esque.
Oh, wow.
But like, but all like hipsters. But there's this photo of my friend who plays in that band, the Vivian Girls. She's like pouring champagne down her like bikinied body, and some guy's drinking it below her. Like, it's just like,
dude, it sounds awesome, man, and it'll be fun.
Well, it's gonna be weird.
I mean, if you're into that stuff, I guess.
There were four marriages that were four relationships that started that have ended in marriages last year at the Bruce Cruise.
Oh, okay. So
that's in the brochure.
But like, people left their wives and got married to other people. Like, I mean, like,
that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
So marriages have been made and broken.
Well, but the four marriages were out. Some of them were from broken marriages that new relationship broke.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, it's gonna be
weird. Know, you put people, I guess, of a certain, I don't know, demographic into the same close space for a long time, and you put liquor in there. And
oh, exactly. Well, that
stuff's gonna happen.
That's the reality TV show model.
Remember that show Temptation Island?
Oh, yeah. Incredible!
They put couples on an island and encourage them to cheat on their spouses.
With a bunch of horny, hot other people.
Yeah,
models. Yeah
models,
actors
that are there basically prostitutes.
I remember that was the first time I was like, I feel dirty about just life. That this is. A hit on television.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's.
I think we should do a montage of these like breaks.
Segues
and the breaks are great, man.
Where are
the
we?
The best of the January 9th.
I can say that today the Review Away podcast has gone from being a wrestling podcast to a wrestling / life podcast.
Yep.
We're a life podcast.
Just talking about life.
It's a weird branch out.
Oh, are you next or me?
Yeah, David Warden. The amazing thing about this event is how much the featured roster had changed from...
No, I read that one.
Oh, sorry, never mind. Chris Bellis. This is still my favorite Rumble event. I love the payoff to the Bret and Owen dissension build, and the opening match was solid in the casket match, if not entirely satisfying. At least built The Undertaker up as a character that one man alone couldn't defeat. Unfortunately, the resulting angle following, the search for Taker and fake Taker versus real Taker, stank like rotting fish heads. I remember watching this event live on Sky Sports in the UK and being gripped by the finish of the Rumble match. Overall, this event had way more pluses than minuses, so I give it a 9 out of 10.
Trey Davis writes, I remember begging my mom to buy this pay-per-view. She finally gave in and told me it could be part of my early birthday gift. Owen turning heel still sticks to me to this day because I remember being a kid wondering if it was all real. I was a fan of the Rumble match finish because it was so different and unique. What makes me remember this pay-per-view most of all is the fact I got very sick that night from a stomach virus and ended up throwing up all night. Overall, I give this show a 8 out of 10.
What is it?
Love it aside, it was awesome.
Why is it?
Imagine how this
on his birthday.
What would you have given this show if you had been feeling 100%? I wonder.
Might have hit the 9 territory.
Yeah,
we seem to be getting a lot of details about all of your personal childhood lives with this show.
Well, because it's a life podcast.
It's a life podcast. Yes. Let's go to Zach Volk. Having a tie ending on paper sounds anticlimactic, but how they executed it was awesome and very ballsy. They executed the fall over the top so perfectly that they could replay it from a ton of angles. And it really looked like a draw. Well, I mean, the way I watched it on this video, it seemed like obviously the camera people knew not to get too close and not to show anything from the side that they were.
Yeah, but you know what? I remember afterwards they did show that angle and they pretty much hit
target. Which was really impressive. I mean, because
what was more impressive was that Batista Cena thing, because everyone thought it was legit because that was perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Too perfect for those guys at that time in their careers. So it had to have been an accident.
It's amazing to me. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, maybe someday they would come out and say, we actually worked all you guys. It was actually intentional. But at least with Brett and Luger, they had, from between the time of the, Fatu's and Michaels' elimination and that spot, like, they had no time to think about it. It was just, like, one thing after another, and they did everything perfectly, so.
That's why I think probably off. Putting together the Royal Rumble would be a really interesting thing to find out how they do it. Like,
it's guys, usually Patterson and Hayes, I think, today who do it.
But are guys getting, like, you know, because you obviously have to kind of put it together on the fly a little bit too, but are guys getting like updates from the agents? Like, okay, here's what's going to happen now. Go out and tell those guys.
I think, you know, like the key spots, like you'll build up to the big monster elimination spot and kind of,
and you know, when you're going, when you're coming.
Especially in, like the last 10 years, it's like they put a lot of thought into the Rumble. I always, despite whatever booking catastrophes you see throughout the year, it seems Mania time they get very serious.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the Rumble is usually, I find, a really well put together match. Mm-hmm. And we will finish off here with Rich Bergman. By far the worst Rumble I've ever seen, and I'm a huge Rumble fan. It was one controversial finish after another. Way overkill. I wonder if Scott Hall was hurt, drugged out of his mind, or just that shitty of a performer, because his performance against a man whom I consider a good to great performer, Mike Rotundo, was god-awful. The only positives I took from this pay-per-view were the fact that Luger didn't screw up the finish. Getting two guys to hit the floor at the same time could not have been easy, and I give them credit for that. The other was hearing IRS work up the crowd before the match. I felt IRS was a master at that. Overall, I give the show a 3.
Whoa.
So there. Ending it on a dour note.
Well, thank you all for your feedback, and thank you, Damien.
No, thank you guys for having me. It's been, as I say, like, I don't know how much of this you guys are going to hear because this has been a marathon session.
We have been talking for 15 hours.
You and I did 10 hours in 2 days, I don't think there's a...
Well, I was going to say, I think next year, because I was in Australia, of course, when you guys were doing the marathon, or I would have come down, because I would have loved to have been there, because if you guys have to do another marathon show, I think you know who can fill the dead space.
Yeah.
The dead air.
Damien, you are always, always welcome here.
No, I've had a great time. Like, this is my, I like to love just coming to be able to talk about wrestling.
Well, what's coming up other than the Bruise Cruise?
What am I doing? We're playing in Kingston coming up, Montreal, and then we're kind of just taking it easy. We don't really have a lot booked right now, and so we're going to probably do some festivals and things like that. It's just like, our last tour we just did was the best tour I've ever been on in my entire life. And so I know nothing is going to be that good ever again.
But before rumors start, you're not breaking up.
No, we're not breaking up. No, no. But I just,
where did that start from?
It started from me kind of being like, I'm sick of touring. And, you know, people kind of took that and assumed that it meant that, like, you know, and it was me just kind of also trying to think out loud when I was talking to someone in an interview. Not the best thing to do when you're being interviewed.
That's what Twitter's for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you should work out all these things publicly as publicly
veiled
as possible.
Messages. That's the way to go.
I started getting all these people going, are you quitting? Are you quitting? And I had to be like, no, I'm not quitting. I can't quit because it's too amazing. Like, it's just too much of a fantasy world to ever quit. But at the same time, touring is, you know, as we talk about with wrestlers, like, touring does take a lot out of you in a way that it's not hard work. You know, it's not like you're doing something labor intensive or anything like that. But psychologically, you, everyone in a band goes crazy, like a wrestler. You know,
yeah, that's the part I could never adapt to. It's just the travel. Like, I can just do a fucking mini vacation and like two flights and I'm done. It's like I don't want to travel for another year after that.
I would be quite content to never travel again. Like, I would be – I love not traveling. I love being places, but I hate the traveling process.
A lot of the bigger guys who can afford it on the road, they've got their own buses
and stuff.
It's just the idea of traveling is just too much.
You know, touring in a van with five people, I imagine, is a lot like touring in a sedan with four people that are big wrestlers. You know, like, there's – or six people in the van, sorry, with us. And it's like, yeah, just it like – It's also, you're so self-absorbed when you're on the road because your life is consumed with yourself. You know, your only concerns every day is, what am I going to do to entertain myself today? What am I going to eat today? And what am I going to do after the show? And those are your only concerns. So you're just so self-absorbed, so self-involved that eventually I think that's what pickles your brain, is just that you just forget how to relate. Like, oh, yeah, I'm not in a bubble. And because you don't talk to the people in your van after a while, because your band is, you know, I've exhausted every possible topic with the people in my band, and they don't like wrestling, and I don't like expensive dinners, so we don't have a lot to talk about. So yeah, you're just by yourself. Like, that's why I think, you know, having the archives on that European tour was so great for me. Like, the Review Away archives I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about any other archive. And, or the Best Show archives, too. The Best Show on WFMU, I also stand by. But, like, so having these archives where I can go and listen to and kind of go and get taken away from this self-absorbed little world you're into.
To our self-absorbed world.
To your little self-absorbed world.
In this broom closet.
But we all have little self-absorbed worlds, you know? Yeah. So you don't have to focus on it as much when you're not on the road.
And with wrestling, you never run out of things to talk about.
No, exactly. Exactly. Like, you know, you can never – and also when you listen to the podcast, like, you know, it starts off the imagination. Like, how would I have booked the invasion angle? Or how would I have saved the invasion angle when it became the alliance? Or how would I have done this? Or how would I have done that? So,
do you have a chance to chat wrestling with you know, any of the people on tour?
Yeah, actually, I've actually met quite a few listeners of this show all over the world, literally all over the world.
That's amazing. I saw the one guy with like the sign.
Yeah, that was in Trondheim, Norway.
That was so cool.
And then I met another guy in Sweden who gave me a data key with all the wrestling on it. And in England, I've met guys that have come up to me and been like, "Oh, I listen to Review Away." And
I think really England cool. per capita has to have the most amount of wrestling fans. It's just amazing. Like,
yeah,
TNA is like about to go over there. They have a giant market over there.
I think wrestling there is looked at culturally different than it's looked at here.
Yeah,
you know, like wrestling there, like it seems like the majority of people that you come across that are into wrestling are savvy fans. Like, you don't want to necessarily say a smart mark or whatever, but like they're like a, you know, like you don't really meet anyone there who's like walking around in a John Cena shirt, unless it's very deliberate. Like, they're wearing the John Cena shirt as a reaction to being told to boo him now.
They're smart, is what you're saying.
Yeah, there's like a real...
Not
like,
dumb like us North Americans.
Well, I don't even think it's dumb like us North Americans, but I think there's like this, you know, like there's a real tradition of like world of sport. Like, you know about English wrestling. You
and
know?
Maybe theater as well.
Yeah, like, but like, yeah, theater too, you know. I think also in England there's, you know, we're talking earlier about obsessions, and England is somewhere that people get obsessed with things, be it antiques, be it, you know, pro wrestling, be it cricket, be it whatever.
It rains all the time. What else are you supposed to do?
Exactly. But also, you know, we play a show in England, and I walk out, and I'm like, rest in peace, Big Daddy, and the whole crowd will clap and erupt. But if I walk on stage in you know, North America and I'm like, rest in peace, Mike the Gladiator, awesome. No one acknowledges it.
Savage would get a pop here.
Savage would get a pop. I think because he transcended it to, yeah, snap it to a Slim Jim.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But yeah, like it's, I think there it's just a generally a different sort of wrestling environment.
I really wonder how many guys today are going to be that culturally significant. Like, John Cena's probably at that. You add this nostalgia factor in of when these kids are older, these 10-year-olds that when they're 25.
Yeah, like I guess John Cena will, because he's also been so public of a figure. You know, but I think CM Punk will, because CM Punk's the guy that's getting, you know, reference now outside of the world of wrestling.
Yeah. But nowhere near the level of a Savage or Hulk in the 80s, man. Like, you're I don't know how, if your wife follows at all. Like, your wife probably knows because you probably, you know, watch it around.
Yeah.
But, like, my mom knows Hulk Hogan. My dad knows Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, no, everyone knows
Hulk
Hogan.
I don't think many parents are going to.
But Hulk Hogan's like the Michael Jordan.
Exactly, yeah.
Not skill level, but he's the Michael Jordan in like, you know, public
awareness.
In skill
level,
he is the most talented wrestler ever. He's the best wrestler ever. But no, like, that's the thing. You got these guys that are
household names,
yeah. You know, and I don't know if John Cena, like, I don't know if I don't think if you can become a household name now.
The industry's like, it's not that popular.
Well, like, I imagine if I had been on the cover of Spin magazine in 1994.
Sure.
I couldn't walk down the street, but it would be a lot different now. I haven't been recognized once. You know, and I'm not being like, I haven't been recognized once, my life is falling apart, but like, I just think that's indicative of how much media is out there now.
Do you look at that as Spin not being as popular or music not being as popular?
I think music's more popular now, but I think the fact is that you don't have the universality of music. Like, it's not like Public Enemy. Public Enemy came out, everyone liked Public Enemy. Like, the guys from Sloan met at a Public Enemy show.
Wow.
You know, like, there's
television's not that different either. I mean,
yeah.
You tell me as a kid, okay, you'll be doing stuff on television. It's like, I get noticed, I think, more for this, doing this podcast when I go out rather than stuff I do on the Fight Network.
Well, you talk about Dallas, you know, like JR, when he was shot, it was like, who shot JR? And that's like a cultural wide thing. But now it's like, you know, you look at the shows that are amazing on TV, they don't win in the ratings. NCIS wins. You know, The Wire was never number one in the ratings. It was NCIS that was number one in the ratings. And now it's just like, you can be, you know, you could be with your group of friends and all of you watch The Wire and just reference it constantly. But there's you know, people beside you that have never seen The Wire.
Like, you had major shows even in the 90s. Like, that last show of Seinfeld, I don't know the exact number, but it was something ridiculous. Like, 60 million that watched. And outside of the Super Bowl, what does that today?
Yeah.
Like, maybe, you know, nothing's hitting that high.
No, and outside of a sports event, you can't think of a single TV show. Maybe the 2.5 Men premiere where the Ashton Kutcher came and they killed off Charlie Sheen's character.
18 or 20.
The thing is, like,
and that's considered gigantic.
Yeah, huge.
Like,
yeah.
Live programming is not as much of a, you know, it's not as important these days with the internet, with PVRs. The only way
live sports still has live a value
because
you need to watch it live. That live.
The other thing is Twitter has really been helping appointment viewing.
Oh, absolutely.
Is what they call it.
Yeah.
It's making watching TV a communal experience again.
Yeah.
That's what I hate about Raw here in Canada, that it's 15 minutes behind.
Yeah.
No, I think if you're a network now, unless you're taking a show that people haven't been exposed to because it's undercovered, but like if you're airing a show 3 weeks behind in America, you're just asking people to download it illegally, or even 15 minutes behind in America.
Yes.
You know, because like you're
Way's smiling. I will completely come out and say it. You know, with us, Fight Network grabbing Tough Enough. It was like, you know, if this was 5 years ago, awesome. But today it's like the people who want to see Tough Enough have seen Tough Enough.
Well, reality TV is something too that people, like, there's no shelf life for it. It's like, you're not going to go back and be like, season 2 of Survivor was awesome. Yeah, it's just like gone.
Because even 10 years ago, it was, I'm the broadcaster and I will tell you when you're going to watch this. You're going to make your schedule free to watch my show at this time. And it's now, it's like, I'll watch a show when I want to, where I want to. And that power has completely changed.
Yeah, and there's no way to assess how big something is now? You talk about the ratings. People aren't like watching. Oh, like when Daniel Bryan and CM Punk and Zack Ryder were in the ring, only 35,000 people or 68,000 or whatever tuned in for the overrun. But it's like, yeah, but like imagine how many people downloaded that illegally afterwards, like to see CM Punk, Zack Ryder. Yeah, like you'd never find out. Like, yeah. You know,
and that's like with pay-per-view piracy. It's like I myself, I know like the day of like big shows, I am getting constant emails from people about, hey, do you know where I can get a link to this? It's like, man, you take that small sample. It's like how many people are watching pay-per-views illegally? You know, is paper? I don't think this product is super hot in the WWE. That numbers are gigantically bigger than what they are, but there's a sizable chunk that are now programmed to find it for free online.
And perhaps that's why there's so much stake now in a service like Twitter, because maybe that is one of the only ways you can gauge how much people are paying attention. By how much they're talking about it.
I think having an impact, but it's funny because WWE is almost like at one point resisting internet fans and the internet fan community. Another point, they're trying to engage it so desperately. Having Chris Jericho come back and not say anything, you can tell like that was the way of finding some way to outwork the internet.
Well, it seems like they're trying to embrace it, but they're not happy with the result. And I mean, maybe they can't be with. But the thing is, the way you're gauging this one demographic is not the way you're attracting the other.
No,
they're different.
And also, like you can expect things to change overnight. Like WWE gave how many years over to reeducating the audience about how to watch the product and what to expect from the product? And it's like, they expect these internet wrestlers that they just promoted to get over 1 week.
And with Bryan, I mean, this guy is overcoming 2 years of being just run down on commentary, and one segment fails, and you can definitely see a less emphasis on Bryan. I mean, he hasn't been put in any position on Raw since that time. Punk hasn't been put in the main event slot since that segment, and that's... If you expect that in 1 week you're going to change things around, I mean, you quickly look at a guy like Austin, who he cut the Austin 316 promo in June of 96. He had the Bret match at WrestleMania the following year, and it was a year after that WrestleMania that the ratings finally turned around for Raw. So you're looking at 20 months it took for Austin to really establish himself. It was like late 97 he was starting to draw numbers, but imagine one segment after King of the Ring where he failed and it's like, okay, not a main eventer.
Could you imagine if they told Bret Hart in 1988, after he was teaming with the Hart Foundation, we're going to give you a magical title shot that you can cash in at any time, and they give the title to Bret in 89.
Well, they give him to him in 89 and he doesn't even win it. He can pin someone after they've
after
been beaten
they make
by
fun
someone
of Bret Hart
else.
For like a solid
nerd.
2 years.
Yeah,
he used to be a cowboy.
Cowboy, Bret
Hart. And also, and then when you do finally give him the win, he still has not won
exactly.
with the title. He got disqualified last week on SmackDown. He deliberately got himself disqualified, and it's just like, how are you expected to like this guy? Like, why wouldn't you have this guy be your Chris Benoit without the creepy stuff meets Rey Mysterio? Like, why don't you have this guy be the guy that you can like that gets over? Or have this guy be the heel that is for some reason that good, even though he's tiny, that he can beat the Big Show and make the Big Show tap out.
Like, whatever they decide, I just think they can't expect an overnight success with anything.
Okay? Look how long it took Zack Ryder to get to his position. That was him doing it himself, but like... That was a good year and a half that he was like kind of building up his own thing, mm-hmm. and then eventually gets kind of over on his own.
It takes focus. It takes audience demand.
You have to get people behind something. Yeah. Like, no one had anything invested in Daniel Bryan as a champion.
You just look at the list of people over the last 10 years it's just patience is the last thing that company has. I mean, Kofi Kingston, who would take that guy seriously now if he was pushed time that we're going to get serious about this guy? No one believes that guy. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have all these examples. It's like, yeah, no one is going to connect with someone overnight because so many times you've seen guys just cut off at the legs.
And is that because there's still so much pressure on popping that rate? And hitting the panic button if ratings don't come out.
I think that's the worst part of the Monday Night Wars was this reliance on television ratings. No one gave a shit about ratings before the Monday Night Wars, but it was something because pay-per-view numbers didn't come out till months later. So you had an instant result of who had the higher rating. And now there's no competition and there's this gigantic fear of losing X amount of viewers when you're not even recouping any of the advertising. I mean, the rating shifting from 0.2 of a rating point really in the bottom line means nothing to the WWE.
Yeah.
So
That concludes 3 hours, folks. It's been awesome.
Let's go. Let's go for another three and go for the record.
Yeah,
we will have to do that sometime.
The record is what, like, what do we say?
Five.
No. But five. I mean, the actual podcast record is like something
for review away.
No, I mean a podcast.
Oh, the real. It's like 76 hours. 76 I looked it up. Hours. We're not hitting.
We're heading there.
And nor would you want to. Like, who do you really think those last? From 70 hour 70 to hour 76 are any good? Like, is there any way those?
Hell of an email signature though.
Oh yeah.
Host of the longest podcast in history.
In history.
Where I talked to a man for 76 hours. Next week, we're gonna chat the 2007 Royal Rumble. See how much 2007 differs from 2012.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And Damien, we would be remiss not to get a song request from you to end things off.
You know what? Let's do "Suck It" by Toronto's own Team Crud Combo.
Awesome.
They were a legendary band featuring Nick Funnyman, local Funnyman Nick Flanagan, and they were probably one of the best punk bands ever from Toronto. And they liked wrestling, and they did a song called "Suck It."
Is this cool? We're off, right?
Yeah.
We'll keep going.
No, this is a song about DX.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cool.